Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
So, Eric, I haven't talked to you since last week's show closing angle with the Young Bucks turning heel, but I kind of came away from the Bucks this week going, all's well that ends well? Are they in a good spot now, the spot we've been waiting, where they are clearly on one side or the other? Can we be confident of that? I think we can be. I think we're seeing the Bucks this week be what people envisioned they would be, one way or the other, in terms of significant personalities in the mix on this show, well-defined for the first time in over 18 months.
Well, I'll give you an answer in two parts. Yes, I think we're finally seeing a consistency to the Young Bucks characters. Nick is still mostly silent. He's not particularly emotive. Matt gives you a little bit more of that, but that's kind of always been the case with their team. Matt's better on the mic, and Nick is the better worker. As for do the ends justify the means, or however you started, I don't know, man. I'm glad they ended up here, but, man, it was inconsistent for how long has AEW been around? I mean, since pretty much the whole promotion, it was shit or get off the pod. It's pick a lane, right? You choose your cliche. But yeah, we did get there tonight from the different costumes. No more tassels. There were, although Matt did have some fringe on his headband, which I thought,
which Callis said is going to sell big in the merchandise table.
Yeah, could be if we ever get fans back. What did you think? You were did they get there eventually?
Yeah. So I said all's well that ends well, which is different. Does the ends justify the means? If we're going to dissect cliches, and you and I could probably do that. I don't think the ends justifies the means, because the way we got here is unjustifiable. I mean, it was just awful and a waste of time, lost opportunities to get the Bucks over, all of that. But all's well that ends well is a little different in the sense that you're sort of saying, I think, we'll forgive the past, not justify it, but forgive it if, and maybe we're willing to give a fresh start because, hey, at least they're, if they can't have a good week and get credit for it, you know, what's the point? So I think this was a really good week. I think it was a good step in the right direction. Don Callis and Matt Jackson cutting promos for that group, with Kenny Omega chiming in with a few weird things, but not overdoing it, while the others kind of cheerlead and Nick sulks, works for me as a dynamic. I want to see them build on it. I want to see them stay away from irony, swerves, and insider references, and watch great 1980s, early 1980s, late 70s promos, and build on that. Because their muscle memory is go to inside references, irony, swerves, winks at the audience. They can go back to that later if it fits in. But I'd say in the meantime, go watch late 70s, early 80s, any great promos, and build on that approach. Because I think the talent is there and the personalities are there, and the heel obnoxiousness is there. And as we saw tonight, the in-ring skill is certainly there with the Bucks. So I'm excited to watch the Bucks next week. And I don't remember ever coming out of an episode of Dynamite in 18 months going, I'm excited to see the Bucks next week. I've seen them in good matches, but it's sort of like that's self-contained. Now I want to see them grow as characters there.
Well, I've never been as down on the Bucks as you have throughout this, even if I've been frustrated at the right. Are they booking themselves type approach. To your point about the insidery stuff, I mean, during that promo near the end of the show that was pre-taped and outside, somebody said during that, what a promo. And when they did the fake super kick, hey, are you doing a rib? I mean, there was some insider terms, but that might have been the Good Brothers who could disappear from television, and I would not miss them a single bit.
And that's what I want them to move away from. That's sort of my point. I'm trying to stress the positive and make a note on what I hope they move away from, because they have enough talent not to have to do that. Like, you don't need to pop us. Like, I always felt Don Callis on commentary and promos, while he had praise heaped upon him, too often I feel like he's trying to pop the boys in the back. Like, his commentary is built, is based around too often, and I know there's this other slice to it, but too much of what he has done over the years seems like it's meant to curry favor with the insider fans who go, ooh, I know what that meant. Yay, he's talking to me. And I want him to grow beyond that. This is national television on TNT. Stop trying to pop the boys in the back and get some internet buzz. And do some money promos. Bring in that second million. Sell some pay-per-view buys. The fans that they're catering to, ultra-catering to with their muscle memory promos of insider references, they got them. And they're going to keep them if they have good matches and good character development. So stop the being the elite stuff. Stop the pop the boys in the back watching on the monitor. And get in the business of selling tickets when they can.
You know, I was going to send a question into the Fix mailbag this week, but I answered my own question in my own head. I was going to say, Wade Keller, is it possible that there is a way to draw money that is not just the sort of time-honored way that you'd like to see the promotion draw money? And I thought maybe that's what AEW is doing, and then I realized, oh, yeah, they haven't been able to break beyond the first million fans. So I think I answered my own question. Can you draw money a different way, the sort of the way the Bucks and Omega have done since the lead up to All In with being the elite? And I guess the answer at the end of the day is yes, to a certain point. You got to try something different to get the next million, maybe. It might be your sort of old-timey traditionalist approach. Maybe that's the way to go.
Yeah,
it has always worked.
Yeah, and I'll push back against old-timey. I mean, I think good grammar is timeless in newspaper writing, right? Like, if somebody starts not following grammar, you know, oh, you're old-timey wanting me to use a comma properly, or not say try and do, but say try to do, because that's clearly better and correct, and not a sloppy colloquialism. So I push back against this framing, because I think if you do that, you sort of define it in a way where needlessly people who are currently in the business go, well, I want to move it forward. But to me, you don't move it forward by taking a train off the tracks because you think a train on tracks feels old school. A train's on the tracks because you need parallel metal strips for the wheels to stay inside. That's timeless. That's how you move a train. And I think you sell tickets by immersing people in an environment that subtracts, as you grow larger, the wink, nod, insider stuff.
I mean, I think they've proven they can get to a million fans and sell out mid-sized arenas with this approach. But I think the theme of this year, and since they debuted Sting in December, has been how do we get to the next million? They may, I don't know if they've acknowledged that or not, but it's certainly been a theme on these podcasts. Yeah, and it's I think you don't pay money to bring in Sting and Big Show and Christian Cage and Mike Tyson unless you are looking to grow the audience. Cody doesn't do the mainstream TV appearance unless, you know, you're trying to bring in new fans. That's what it's all about, whether they've publicly acknowledged that or not.
Yeah, and I want to say, a little wink to the audience now and then, I'm cool with. I'm not going to, like, you know, throw my, you know, sandwich at the TV screen. If there's some, you know, comment where you can, you know, it's got an undercurrent of insider reference and some people get it, some don't. What I don't want is for them to think that job well done, if they're clever, super serving the being the elite type audience. And so that's what I'm – it's not like I'm, oh, you can never break – the fourth wall or anything. You can do that stuff. Just don't make it seem like that's how you judge whether you've succeeded. And yeah, I mean, I think they ought to want to grow beyond the level that they're at. Now, I would adjust my thinking and my viewpoints if I saw evidence that it was kind of a passe or it had its time, had its day, and something else is working. But I think the evidence is it's time to try something different to get that next level. They're successful. I think they have reason to be proud of where they are, often a top 10 demo show on TNT on cable. That means less than it did 5, 10, and 20 years ago, but it's still something, and it's enough to keep them around. I just want to see them kind of step back and go, hey, can we learn from the all-time greats? Are there some things that we were doing? Like the Bucks once said, Eric, in a promo. No, in some sort of interview. I wish I could remember it and credit it. Actually, it was probably at I don't know if it was at All In or not. But anyway, it doesn't matter. It does matter. I just can't remember. They said, all we need are 2,000 fans. And if they spend $200 a year on us, we can make a good living. 2,000 fans, $100, $200 each, they can make a good living. They can make, you know, $100,000 some dollars on the indie scene, but we need 2,000 hardcore fans who will follow us, drive, buy merch, buy all the new t-shirts. That's great, and that worked for them. But it's TNT. You're drawing 800, 900, a million people. You're on pay-per-view. You got to change that approach now and broaden out the appeal. And that's what I'm arguing for. I don't think what they did was wrong. I just think they're on a different stage, different platform now.
You mean the company's less than 2 years old, and I think – to me, AEW falls into that same category that New Japan does. I have loved a lot of the product in recent years, and I hold them to a higher standard. Like when I'm grading a pay-per-view, I say, oh, WWE, that's very good. Even if a match is, you know, 3.5 stars, I'm like, wow, a bunch of 3.5 stars. Whereas I expect 5-star matches on a New Japan and on AEW pay-per-views. So it's there is somewhat of a you know, a higher bar for the promotions that are doing better creatively than WWE.
Yeah. All right. Well, good opening discussion. Let's introduce ourselves and give out the phone numbers. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, April 14th, 2021. I'm Wade Keller, editor, publisher of the Pro Wrestling Torch weekly newsletter. And I'm joined today by Eric Kroll, a former Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter columnist circa 1990. That's crazy, Eric. I know we always say that, but
I know, but you know, I would point out that even if the listener here might think you're trying to drag me for being so old, it also means you've been publishing the Torch for more than 30 years. So let's not forget that.
I think it's something to be proud of that 30 years ago, you're writing for the newsletter. The newsletter's still in business, and here we are talking wrestling. I mean, I think that's cool. Yeah, definitely not trying to drag you. It's fun to have you back on after having you on my radio show on KFAN in the early 90s. And man, if you would have said in like 2021. At the end of an international, near the end, hopefully, of an international pandemic, we were still talking wrestling or had come around to talk wrestling again. I think that'd be awesome.
Yeah, would not have foreseen that.
How about 2052? What are you doing?
We'll be talking through the chips in our brains, I think.
Yes, yes. Speaking of talking, we want to add to the conversation here. And if you're listening to us live, you can join the conversation. Our phone number is 347-215-8558. 347-215-8558. Push 1 on your keypad if you want to be part of the conversation tonight. You can also email us at wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. So many topics we can get to. We've already got some good emails that we'll get to, but we don't want to leave the callers waiting too long. So let's begin to march through calls, and we'll certainly cover more topics than just the Bucks, Callis, and Kenny. And that other team you want to see go away, Eric. And we'll begin here with area code 801. 801, go ahead and state your name and where you're calling from.
This is Derek, and I'm from Utah.
Hey, Derek, it's been a while. Now, let me say this, and you might be one of those people, but I meant to insert this a minute ago. If anybody watched Dynamite tonight, you normally watched NXT on Wednesday nights, I'd really like to hear from you and get your impression of the show. You probably watched some of it, but, like, how'd you feel about your Wednesday now being by default, if you're going to watch First Round Wrestling, AEW instead of NXT? So consider yourself invited. Derek, over to you. I don't know if you're one of those people, but welcome.
I am indeed one of those people. I think I've watched almost every AEW Dynamite, but most of the time I watch it after the fact on Thursday or sometimes Friday after I'm done with school, and I watched NXT live because it's the product that I prefer of the two. Not saying I don't like AEW, just NXT generally kind of fits my need as a wrestling fan more. But with that said, you know, watching Dynamite tonight, this is one of the best Dynamites I've seen, not because the wrestling itself was better than usual, though I think on the large it was. But generally, when I watch AEW, there's always been one or two segments that's kind of groan-inducing or a match between people who just kind of come across as amateurs to me or not big league or not ready for the big leagues. And tonight, there was none of that. I thought it was a really solid show from start to finish.
Eric, let me ask you, because we've talked very specific in the micro. Step back, macro. Was this a good episode of Dynamite, especially in the context of it being a show that is going to be, it's going to have been watched live by a bunch of people who normally weren't watching it live and probably a bunch of people who didn't watch them very much anyway. NXT last night was up substantially in viewership. And we've got details at pwtorch.com on that if people want to dig into the numbers. But it was an increase for NXT. So certainly I expect AEW to be up too. NXT went from 768,000 viewers for TakeOver last week to 805,000 this week. And they're well above their 653,000 average in the first quarter of this year, up around 150,000. So I expect AEW to have an increase too. So, Eric, was this a good show in general and a good show in the context of we're introducing ourselves to some new fans or trying to win people over who only watched us on delay?
Yeah, it was a good show for in both contexts. I mean, the show itself, if you were you had a great match at the start, a world-class tag team match. You had a good match in the middle with Jericho and Dax Harwood. And then you had this overbooked spectacle at the end with a guy.
Tony accepts the compliment.
Yeah, and yeah. Cody thought that main event was a bit overbooked, to give you an idea. I'm kidding.
Probably.
You know, you had if you tuned in, you got the great match at the start, and then you saw Chris Jericho in the middle and Matt Hardy at the end. So if you were a new fan, hey, those are guys I recognize. It allows you to ground yourself a little bit. As for I think this show, it had more room to breathe. It didn't feel quite as breakneck paced where they were jamming in 50 things. There were more video setups. There were a couple squashes, and there were actually two women's matches this week, which I guess when they were going head to head, they never thought they could do more than one because it would kill them in the ratings or something. So that was noticeable. And then they had angles from last week were followed up on, which isn't always the case with AEW. It's one of the frustrations is they have a hot angle and they don't follow it up. But I think all the hot angles from last week were followed up, including the Bucks coming out at the start of the show to say, here's why we turned, right? In a pre-taped
very top, yes.
Promo. Yeah. And then you had Tyson, a great MJF Tyson, quick little skit backstage that again, followed up on something that happened last week. So to that extent, they seem to try to be answering their critics a little bit. That's for AEW, in my experience, that's made easier when the show is taped as opposed to when it's live. When it's live, they still are working out some of the kinks in that regard. And they don't have chances to do sort of overdubs on the commentary. Like they're very noticeable when Tony or Excalibur does an overdub and they drop it in. But
I don't know what you mean by that.
Yeah. But you know, I think slowing it down a little bit, And to Derek's good point, no amateurs on the show that's turned him off in the past. We didn't have Marco Stunt. We didn't have kind of the more indie guys out there sticking out a little bit like a sore thumb. And so probably they got off to a good the right foot with some of the NXT folks and who might be watching for the first time or watching and not flipping back and forth for the first time.
Yeah. Derek, did this – Is AEW going to be destination Wednesday nights for you now in addition to watching NXT on Tuesdays, or is that too much?
You know, when I'm available, I make a point to watch live wrestling. So, yeah, for sure. I think I've caught almost every episode. I think the difference that I noticed tonight is in the past, I mean, you brought up like amateur hour, but it's not just, I don't want to like discredit the talent saying they come across as amateurs. I just think a lot of times, like especially with the women or some of the less experienced guys, their matches are going like 10 minutes where I'm like, man, if this was 5 minutes, this would be so much better. And I think a good example tonight is we know Jada Cargill and Red Velvet are not the most experienced, but I thought they were at what they were asked to do tonight to fill the time that they were asked to fill. They did a good job, and it didn't feel like it was bloated or they were doing things that they shouldn't do on live TV with a live, television audience. It felt right. Like it felt like pros. They looked like pros out there. They moved with meaning. They packed the impact. It wasn't perfect, but the aggression was there, and a lot of times I see, especially with spot matches, it seems like choreographed movements instead of two people who are trying to knock the other one down. And I thought those women did a really good job of the intensity, the impact, and the purposefulness of what they were doing was definitely intact, which you don't always see with less experienced wrestlers. So I thought those gals did a really good job.
I think it's smart, too, when they do the live tape rotation, you know, to strategically put some of the greener wrestlers in an environment with less pressure. So if there is a screw-up, you know, like Rhea Ripley and Asuka, it would have been nice to redo the spot at WrestleMania that didn't go well, or was it Raw, or was it both? And so, you know, when there's less experience, if something goes really wrong, it gives them a net where something can be edited, and that might be something, God, if I went back and looked, maybe we would see a pattern there, you know, where you can round out some of the rough edges or go to a different camera angle in retrospect and post-edit. But it's a good observation, Derek. What else do you think of?
I think my last comment, and then I'll let you guys get on to other callers, and this kind of piggybacks on your conversation on the Bucks to start the show. This is the version of the Young Bucks that I think is the most successful, where they can still hit their high-flying moves and their innovative offense. But if you notice when they were doing some of their trademark offense today, the in-between stuff is where they have, you know, the smirk or the taunting,
yep,
or things of that nature. And I think they're going to be well-served in this environment, because I remember in Ring of Honor, I kind of felt like in getting themselves over, they killed the product because they were supposed to be heels, but they just completely undercut every babyface team that they worked with because the babyfaces couldn't get over because the Bucks were doing the better, more entertaining offense, and the crowd was eating the Bucks, you know, eating the Bucks stuff, cheering like mad for them, and all the other guys who were trying to outspot the Bucks, they're just going to come across as second best. But in this environment where the crowd's not going to organically get behind the Bucks because it's a smaller arena, I think it's going to allow babyface teams to get the one up on the Bucks, which works when they're showing that smirky, arrogant, taunting mannerisms that they do. The only reason the heel does that is so the babyface can stick it to him. And in this environment, when the babyface sticks it to him, the crowd's going to cheer instead of cheering the Bucks. So I think this could work really well, and I think this is the best version of the Bucks, and it's going to be helped by the current environment that we're in.
Yeah, no, really good point. I want to get Eric's thoughts on kind of the future of the Bucks in the context of how to best feature them as heels, with the goal being to get booed, not get the ironic cheers. During that match, they showed, I was going to say Lucha House Party, Luchasaurus and Jungle Boy at ringside, SCU, and Butcher and Blade and Bunny. She seemed like she was ready to fall asleep, but that was intentional. Do they have enough teams that the Bucks will be booed against? Because, like, when I look at the landscape, I think eventually Jericho and Sammy as babyfaces against the Bucks works. You can have Eddie Kingston and John Moxley against the Bucks. That would work. I think the fans would cheer the babyface teams there. But as far as the full-time tag teams, do they have enough where the Bucks have the opponents necessary to not end up being the cool, cheered heels, which I hope is not AEW's goal?
I mean, to Derek's point, the Bucks got over big in New Japan. They're, you know, national, I guess, sort of, it was a big stage for them. They got over, and they were cool heels, right? I mean, there's a reason everyone's wearing Bullet Club merchandise a number of years ago, even if they didn't know what the hell the Bullet Club was. It was the cool heel thing. And so for them, the psychology in this match with Phoenix and Pac was different. Normally, I mean, it was the standard psychology of a match. It's just the Bucks have been on the opposite side of it for so long, selling as baby faces like crazies to do the hot tag, which, you know, is a tried and true formula. They were getting the heat on Phoenix and Pac today, and Phoenix and Pac are, I guess, tweeners. So you could see, as for teams for them to face, you could see them being, you know, you could see them facing some tweener teams, and maybe it's heel versus heel, but the opponents are shading a little more babyface in that particular match to make up for the fact that they don't have a bunch of hot babyface teams ready. You could turn Private Party, and they could be a babyface team that could get a run with the Bucks, and you've got Jungle Boy and Luchasaurus as you noted. The Bucks in their promo
Santana and Ortiz, by the way.
Yeah, near the end of the show, you've got they put the tag team division on notice, which was weird because they're the champions, but they called out SCU, Best Friends, and Butcher and Blade. So I don't know if that's the those are the matches they're settling to, they're heading toward, but, you know, there's been that SCU storyline where the next time they lose a tag match, they're breaking up as a team, and that was always destined to end with SCU losing to the Bucks on TV and then breaking up. Best Friends are good for, you know, a short run. They are maybe not holding the belts for 6 months or anything, but they can be penciled in, do at least reasonably well in a feud as the baby faces before before losing. So, yeah, I mean, you can...
Hopefully blown off on TV, not pay-per-view.
Yeah, I think, you know, I guess there's enough.
Yeah.
They have enough wrestlers on the roster who are underutilized. That they, and they have so many tag teams, they've got an endless supply of people they can heat up. Wins on Dark and Dark Elevation and Dark the Third and Dark the Fourth, and they can have them number one in the rankings based on a bunch of squash wins and pull the trigger on it.
Quality of opposition is not a big factor in AEW rankings, and Britt Baker sort of made a mockery of that, you know, with her, I'm going to go win a bunch of matches on Elevation against nobody's, and then I'm going to be number one contender, and she's sort of kind of hanging a lantern on that flaw in the system, such as it is at this point.
Was that too meta for you, Wade?
What?
Oh, Britt Baker. Yeah.
Oh, no, that was...
Okay. I know sometimes you clutch your pearls about the insider references and when they get to excess, so I wanted to take your temperature to see where the line is drawn.
I think that's totally storyline. I mean, I think she's like, I'm going to be 12-1 and I'm going to get a title shot. I mean, that's a heel taking advantage of the system the same way a heel taking advantage of a distracted referee is taking advantage of the system. It's not, I mean, the record is, it's a legit record, but it's in the storyline. So it works for me. Yeah. So anyway, Derek, any closing words from you, and then we'll get to a bunch of other people on hold here.
Yeah, I think Wade, your suggestion of putting the Bucks against Jon Moxley and Eddie Kingston is probably the best in my perspective, because when I see like a babyface team that's ultra athletic but very proud of themselves for being such, I kind of just want to see more guys who are more aggressive and more street, for lack of a better term. You just want to see those guys get beat up. I mean, it's the old Shawn Michaels 7, where when Shawn Michaels was so cocky, chomping on his gum the way he does, which is the way the Young Bucks chomp on their gum. You want to see someone punch that guy in the face. And in 97, that was The Undertaker. You want to see The Undertaker just beat the living daylights out of Shawn Michaels. And I think the Young Bucks, given the heel mannerisms they were showcasing today, I want to see Jon Moxley and Eddie Kingston not do spot for spot with the Bucks. I want to see them punch the Bucks in the face. And to me, that works. That's a matchup that works on that level. So thanks for taking my call, gentlemen. And I hope to talk to you again on a Wednesday.
Sounds good, Derek. Good to hear a new voice here on the show with the new schedule. Thanks for all the good comments. Yeah, by the way, Taz's son, as Taz's son is called, was the one chomping on gum this week. So he's got that gimmick cornered at this point. I like the idea, you know, the analogy and pulling from history like that, Eric, makes sense. You know, just having the big bad Undertaker just punch Michaels, and Michaels bump like crazy for him. I mean, the Bucks are good at getting sympathy and doing the hot tag, but they can also sell like crazy in a way that's going to make the baby faces pop. And some of the great heels in history have made their money off of the, you know, whether it's Nick Bockwinkel's great bumps or Shawn Michaels' great bumps. Steve Austin as a heel is stunning, Steve, especially just great flat back bumps. There's all these, this lineage of people who just take great bumps for baby faces. And, you know, Tully and Arn in their day to Dusty's Bionic Elbow. That there's money to be made there, and the Bucks should be great at that if they, you know, go if they lean full in on that.
Laid out the path for where they're headed for the next pay-per-view at the end of May. I think they're definitely headed toward, I would think that Moxley needs a match, right? And it's Moxley and Eddie Kingston versus the Bucks, and Eddie Kingston can eat the pin, and they can have the punchy thing that you laid out.
Yeah, yep. One thing I'll say with the Bucks is, and this applies to kind of the meta stuff, which, like I said, I'm okay a little bit here and there. don't hang your hat on that as a success story because you happen to hit a few insider comments out of the park to pop the boys in the back and the insider fans. So with that as kind of the layout, I feel the same way about the matches with the Bucks. Like curate a little bit. Like I thought mocking the hot tag and the riling up the crowd, like that's great. You know, I like that's what. But when he dropped to his knees and did the crocodile tears at the expense of his opponent recovering, it seemed like one step too far. Just save that for the next match. Don't fit it all. Don't try to put it all into one match. And you want to have respect for the Bucks that they're not just so into showboating that they don't take the match seriously, like at this stage of the game. And I thought that was just one section I would have edited out of them sort of mocking the whole situation now being heels.
Yeah, as Han Solo once told Luke Skywalker, don't get cocky, kid.
Yes. All right, we'll go to 781 next, and then 410 we'll probably go to after that. 781, go ahead, state your name and where you're calling from. Uh, 781, are you muted? We can't hear you. 781, I'm going to hang up on you. If you get hung up on, that was you. And then just call back and push 1, and we'll bring you in next in line. 410, you are up. Go ahead, state your name and where you're calling from.
Steve from Baltimore.
Hey, Steve, good to hear from you. Yeah, so what'd you think of Dynamite tonight?
Overall, I liked it a lot. Main event, though, I think they went overboard with the kicking out of the Twist of Fate on the chair and then the leg drop off the ladder. Just unrealistic that somebody's going to kick out of that stuff.
Yeah, Eric, what'd you think about that? Did it go too far? I mean, you had your wry explanation of how they would frame it or how people critic. I felt it worked both ways. Some people go, yeah, that's a compliment, but it wasn't necessarily meant as such.
Yeah, I mean, as Steve noted, I literally in my notes wrote down, shouldn't a Pillmanized Twist of Fate outside the ring be a finisher?
Yeah.
And same for a leg drop through a table? Shouldn't that have been the finisher? Right? I asked those questions. And then when I saw him hitting the coffin drop through a table off the scaffolding, I thought, well, for sure that's the finisher. And not just because it was 8:59 p.m. Central when that happened.
Right.
But yeah, they, you know, Jim Cornette will be having an aneurysm tomorrow if he has a show tomorrow. I'm not a listener, but shouldn't that have been the finisher? I had other questions about this match, though, too. The overbooked part is like Ethan Page and Scorpio are coming down. Okay, so I get Dark Order versus the Hardy Family Office because that's been established for a few weeks, but this other random team decides to interject, and then Lance Archer comes out, and why is he saving Sting? Is it because Sting said something nice about him last week during the promo, like you're a star, you should be booked like a star, or whatever Sting said? And then why did Sting leave after tossing Darby the bat? I mean, bad stuff still could have happened. There, you know, if you are looking at that main event match from a critical standpoint, with a critical eye, lots of questions left. I mean, it was still fun, right? If you turn your brain off, it was, you know, crashing through tables and Pillmanized chairs to the head, and it was enjoyable, but overbooked for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Again, it gets to the whole, I mean, I think I said it pre-Dynamite with AEW, using the term curated. I just, you don't want to go through a museum where there's not a curator and everything in the storage room is just jammed on the walls because more is better. And I think that's just, they're just, you know, editing is called for with AEW. I think it'd be good for them to have somebody with an eye for that to go, okay, I know you're trying to tell the story of Ethan Page and Sky and they're here and you've dropped some hints cutting to on cutaways to them watching and reacting to things. But this, when we step back and look at everything going on in this match, I think we're telling so many stories, we're going to lose some of the effect and leave people just sort of confused. On top of that, like what you said with the finishes, it's, if you're going to have a big spot in a kick out, like, you know, make it count, make it memorable by having it not be followed by three more instances of that. And when you have so much craziness going on, have big spots lead to near falls, but they're not kickouts. It's someone interfering in the pin. It's legal. So you have an excuse to extend a match more believably if somebody's interfering with the cover rather than actually having kickouts, and then it doesn't seem quite as realistic, unrealistic. But I mean, that, you know, in the opening tag, that rightfully so is being complimented. I mean, there was I can't remember the exact spot Ray Phoenix ate, and then like 5 seconds later, he was doing some sort of graceful high spot. You know, I think you can fit in the dazzling moves and do so in a way that doesn't involve, you know, these Tommy Dreamer comebacks, where you get beaten up for 10 minutes and then suddenly, woohoo, you're 100% again with all your powers restored. It's not a video game. So work to make it a little more realistic. And I think it ultimately doesn't make the match less enjoyable when you apply that kind of discipline in editing.
But does that get over with the younger fans? Is that why they have such a strong younger fan base and do better in the demo? Is it they're in their minds, they're taking it to the next level, and that's how they're connecting with younger fans, a new generation, and we're just old and cranky?
I think they're connecting with the new fans because there's cool characters and there's athletic moves. But I think it's a mistake to say because something is present, that's necessarily why, and not peel away the layer and go, that can be present, but it can be present in a better structure with a more realistic presentation. Like, I don't think you need to follow up one high spot with another, because I think it waters down the effect of them all. I think you can have those three high spots that are awesome, but pace them out in a way that just fits a more realistic structure. And I think those young fans are going to still be there for that relative to whatever it is that they're not attracted to about WWE. Steve, anything else for us?
Yeah. Also, when you take into context the whole show, you know, if the referee was applying the same standard that they did for Anthony Ogogo, that match should have been stopped 10 times.
Yeah, that was one of my big gripes on this show. I didn't like. I thought the finish was stupendously stupid, stupendously dumb. The idea that we're trying to put over a boxer, I get that. You're trying to put over that he's, you know, has a great punch. But if every time somebody keeled over because they lost their wind, you stopped the match, I mean, how many times would Hardy and Darby have been stopped? How many times would pretty much every match in all of pro wrestling history have been stopped? You know, it's just, there's other ways to get over a punch without the referee doing something a referee has never done before, which is call off a match because that guy is expressing pain from a move. I just thought that was dumb. Eric, what did it jump out to you?
I mean, after this squash match and the way it was, I still can't tell whether this guy is any good, if he's ready for prime time. I will push back on your stomach punch thing. I think it was just a callback to Ron Garvin, Hands of Stone, and him knocking a guy out with his illegal closed fist. No, I'm just kidding. No, it was terrible. Yeah. It makes no sense. And undercuts makes literally every other wrestler who's ever wrestled look weak by comparison because they couldn't take a punch to the stomach.
Well, all they had to do was have the jobber just wave his hand to the ref, go, I want to stop. I mean, that's all they needed to do. Like, why is there not, you know, a match producer backstage saying, hey, this makes no sense, but if Cole Carter waves off the match with his hand, the ref can go, are you sure? And he goes, yeah. Now you've got the wrestler basically saying, I can't breathe. That's the worst punch I've ever felt before. I've been in matches. I'm a rookie, but I've been in tough matches before and come back. I can't come back from this punch. You'd communicate that, but not put the referee in a position to do something that the referee doesn't do in any other match he has. It comes across as a storyline, a gimmick in search of a finish instead of some sort of logical finish that puts over the gimmick. So, Steve, back to you.
Yeah, or just pin him afterwards, either.
There is that. Totally. And that's the thing. Like, how wild and crazy of you, Steve, to come up with something so unconventional as, I punched a guy and he's so hurt, he can't breathe and he can't kick out.
Yep.
I think the point was to, like, get him over in some sort of MMA modern way, but yeah. It fell flat to me. And you would think when they were looking at the tape, they themselves could tell, but, I mean, they'd already shot the match, so what are you going to do?
Yeah. And Ogogo could move in for another punch, and the ref could go, no, 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 you know, I need to call it off. But he wasn't even doing that. If you're going for MMA, the ref calls off the fight generally, you know, when a guy goes down and then the opponent's going in for more punches, and the ref's like, I just can't submit. I can't leave this guy this vulnerable to more attack. And I would have loved that, but you know, because in wrestling that never happens, but it would have been an extra step of at least self-awareness that you got to do a little something extra. But Steve, yeah, back to you.
That's all I have for tonight. Thank you, guys. Cool.
Thanks, Steve. All good of you. If you're just joining us, this is a Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. We're live streaming after Dynamite on Wednesday, April 14th, 2021. And we're taking calls. 347-215-8558 is the number. Push 1 on your keypad if you want to join us. You can also email the show during Dynamite. This also applies to Raw and SmackDown. During the TV show, you can email us or in the hour or so afterwards and still make it onto the show. Wade Keller Podcast at pwtorch.com. All right, let's go next to 781 callback. 781, we're trying again with you. Please state your name and where you're calling from. Seven, eight, one. Oh, no. They called back. They pushed one. We still can't hear them. Going once. Going twice. Oh, they dropped off. All right. Bye. Sorry. All right. Let's go next to Skype call. 111. You are up. Go ahead. State your name and where you're calling from.
Hey, guys. It's Hinton from London, Ontario.
Hey, Hinton. Good to hear from you. What'd you think of Dynamite tonight?
Yeah, a good show today. Just a couple of notes regarding the opening part. I like the fact that they started with the Young Bucks promo to lead into the match. I just wish they didn't splice in the MJF Mike Tyson segment right in the middle of that. I'd rather they just get the viewer to focus on one thing throughout the show. But speaking of the whole Mike Tyson involvement, first off, I like Chris Jericho's promo before his match with Dax Harwood. I like that I called even last week saying that I like that he's apologizing, because you don't see a newly turned babyface apologize virtually at all, right? So that's a really and the fact that he's continuing to do it, I think, is a strong point. A weakness of the promo was him kind of trying to explain why Mike Tyson was present last week. It's like, I appreciate the effort, but why does a babyface five-man group need backup from a heel five-man group? Like, you should be braver than that. And also mentioned in to Zach last week that there's really no good way for this to end, because either Tyson turns on the Inner Circle and they mimic Austin versus DX from 98, or they keep Tyson a babyface and he joins Inner Circle, which he did today, and it's basically Inner Circle having a one-man advantage over the Pinnacle for, you know, the next time he's on, like during the pay-per-view. So I'm not too fond of the use of Tyson here. Otherwise, I thought the match was good. But yeah, your guys' thoughts on this?
Yeah, Eric, what do you think?
I mean, I think as far as Tyson goes, he was brought in last week because Tony Khan was trying to avoid taking an L to NXT on the last head-to-head live show, and NXT was going to win that just because they had the TakeOver branding and a loaded lineup. And Tyson, they had him there, so they taped tonight's show last Thursday, and so he was just in town. They got a twofer out of the guy. I imagine he's not going to be around week to week. I suppose it's possible he could come back for Blood and Guts if they want to spend the money for another appearance. I really enjoyed MJF insulting Mike Tyson to his face, like, hey, I bet you regret that face tattoo, right? I mean, he had another one, a great one-liner that I thought was fantastic, and I howled at. Tyson's involvement in the match was good. I mean, he took the chair away from Jericho. He you know, tried to keep order. He wasn't in the ring, thankfully. You know, he was outside the ring, because if he was in the ring, it's really hard to be a pro wrestling referee with no experience. And Mike, I believe they've said, is somewhat limited. You never know what you're going to get with the guy. So overall, that was a nice build to May 5th. And unfortunately for Chris Jericho, in the post-match promo with Tyson, Chris Jericho had to stand next to Mike Tyson with his shirt off, and Mike Tyson completely outclassed him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Jericho's beyond. He's beyond the dad bod at this point. He's just the legends can look however they want to look. What you mentioned in your rundown of the show earlier, Jericho and Dax had a good match. Was it what you expected? Were you hoping for more? Did it just kind of what were the highs and lows of the story that they told and the way they told it? In addition to Mike Tyson, you talked about Tyson, but how about just the wrestling between them?
I mean, if you were being looking at it with a hypercritical eye, you would say, well, all hell broke loose during Jericho Harwood, and then the same gimmick repeated itself in the main event with Darby and Matt Hardy. I think they worked hard. Harwood is obviously a great worker who can have excellent matches with opponents. He's used to losing because he was in the WWE for so long, and I think this is his second straight singles TV job. He did one to Jungle Boy a few weeks that you thought might lead to something. I guess it did lead to maybe a tag match, but it met my mid-sized expectations, but did not exceed. What did you think?
Yeah, I thought it was good. I mean, I thought it was good, but it's 2021 Jericho. You know, I mean, he's not, you know, the DDP yoga is not enough, or he's not doing it enough to look like he did when he was 45, and certainly not when he was 38. You know, it's just there's age and lifestyle and weight catching up a little bit, and he's just, you know, he's not the same worker he once was, but he's a smart worker, and I don't think people expect him. You know, he doesn't have to be what he once was to still be really effective and useful, because, you know, his wrestling IQ is just so high. And yeah, Dax is just super good. I mean, it was a fun match. You know, I mean, good wrestling does not equal a good wrestling show. It's got to be part of it a lot, but sometimes a match is good not because of athletic grace, but because you do other things really well and tell a good story, and the characters are aligned, and the selling is good, and takes people, you know, on a ride. And I think this match took people on a ride. And I agree, Mike Tyson was used really well. Like, that's the curated version of a special enforcer celebrity referee. You know, it's not one token involvement. It was like three or four things he did. But it wasn't overdone, and it contributed to the match. The only thing that was kind of weird is, you know, like Mike saying he's going to be objective, but then posing and joining the group afterwards. Like, I would be a little suspicious of a journalist who conducted a debate, you know, before a governor's race. And then afterwards, well, the family's, you know, mingling with the candidates, goes and stands next to a candidate, and the candidate announces he's joining their team, he's joining their staff. Like, I wouldn't call that retroactively. I'd be a little suspicious of the objectivity of the person leading the debate. And I'm a little subjective about whether Tyson truly didn't have wasn't hoping for a certain finish, Eric.
Well, there is no cheering in the press box, as you know, but there is cheering in a wrestling ring.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Hinton, back to you.
Next point I wanted to bring up was the Britt Baker promo. And my thoughts on this echo very much what Lance Storm has been saying. He sort of put it to words for me, and I'll repeat that here. So since the hardcore match, we've only seen the loser on television. The winner is nowhere in sight, and neither have competed on Dynamite since. And Britt Baker, to this day, was it been 4 weeks, 5 weeks, is promoting a match on Dark Elevation, and there is no sight of Thunder Rosa at all. It doesn't feel like they followed up strong on this, and I feel like Dynamite runs into this pattern of they do something really good, like they did. They did something really strong by putting the TNT title on Brody Lee, and then he just sort of faded into the Dark Order comedy bullshit for a while. Like, they're just not good with the follow-up. I don't know if I'm the only one feeling this way. Well, what do you guys think of Britt Baker's current direction?
Yeah, Eric, how do you grade AEW in that respect broadly, and also Britt Baker specifically?
I mean, I think Thunder Rosa was on tonight in a pre-taped promo near the end of the show, challenging the Serena Deeb, who holds the NWA title. It seemed to be a reset for her. I thought their mistake in the post-hardcore match situation was that was supposed to be the blow-off to the feud, I thought. I mean, logically, that's it, right? Britt wins the feud and moves on and moves up on the card, and Thunder Rosa tries to rebuild herself. But I think to Hinton's point, in the following weeks, I think Britt sort of opened the door that she would beat her in a regular match as well, and they kind of left you with the impression the feud was still going on when it shouldn't be, that should have been it. And so if they didn't do that, I mean, there really is nothing to follow up with Britt Baker and Thunder Rosa, other than, as Hinton points out, individually with those two. And Britt has been sort of floundering. She's got her gimmick now of making fun of the ranking system. I think it's okay to take a breath for a week or two after you have this earth-shattering, groundbreaking women's hardcore match, and you don't have to be on TV the next week. You could be selling your injuries. Thunder Rosa, I don't think she's under contract. I'm not sure how often they have access to her. Maybe whenever they want it. We're in a pandemic. I know she has her own promotion that's running a little bit down in Texas. So yeah, to Hinton's point, I think they did. Thunder Rosa needed to be rebuilt after that, and they're just now getting around to it a few weeks later. But, you know, they started tonight. We'll see where it goes.
Yeah, I agree with Hinton with your point, though. If you're going to have that level of a match, I think what AEW, and I can't come up with examples but off the top of my head, but I think AEW has a tendency to say, let's do something really cool. Let's do something really big. Let's do something spectacular something in and of itself that's worth doing without an eye on, now, as Lance Storm's pointing out, how do we parlay this into something that moves to the next phase for both wrestlers involved? And there's examples where they have followed up just fine, but you don't want to just say, oh, we're going to rock the world with this women's hardcore bloodfest. And, oh, okay, that we got great critical praise. Now we're going to go in a completely different direction with both of the wrestlers involved. But one involves the winner having no momentum, and the other involves Britt Baker trying to work her way up despite the big loss through the flawed ranking system by taking advantage of a flawed system and sort of flaunting it. It's not the best follow-up for a match of that caliber. You'd want to give a spotlight in that kind of match. You'd want to have the wrestlers involved have momentum coming out of it, and, you know, Thunder Rosa lost it. Whatever the logistical reasons are for it, it's sort of forgotten. There's this thing, this image people have of a great match on Dynamite involving a couple wrestlers. There's not a sense that it led to, a big momentum generator. Or a change in Britt Baker's course either. You know, I mean, she just came out bragging about what a good match it was. And you know, so anyway. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I wonder what's next for Sheeta after she disposes of Ty Conti next week. I don't see them putting the belt on Ty Conti. There's a pay-per-view at the end of May. Do they go with finally pull the trigger on the Britt Baker versus Sheeta thing and do the belt switch since Sheeta's had the belt for so long? Or do they have something else planned? Thunder Rosa mentioned she wants to challenge the winner of Sheeta and Conti, and so is that where they're headed? I don't know how you get that after losing your big high-profile match against Britt Baker, but maybe they build her up between now and again. Hinton, where do you think they're going with the next women's pay-per-view title match?
I mean, I think that Tony Khan wants to go back in time and put Britt Baker over on that match because that's what he wants to do. Like, and then he wants to build her up and finally put the belt on her because I'm not really sensing much momentum with Hikaru Shida. I don't know where she's been. Apparently she's been doing some matches in Japan. And I don't think she quite has the charisma to now keep carrying this as like a strong, dominant babyface. They've kind of just done everything they can with her.
Yeah, when you're a weekly TV show built around personalities and drama and feuds and promos, it's tough to go a really, really long time with somebody who doesn't fit into that. They're more the spectacular match now and then. That said, I mean, I think you can make it work, but you got to do everything else really well. And then treat Sheeta as this next level wrestler that if anybody can beat her, it's just going to be this monumental happening. And just, you know, but have everything else. It's kind of Lesnar, you know, when he's Universal Champ. It's like he's not there every week, but everyone's fighting it out to get a chance at him because he is the unbeatable, it's unfathomable to imagine him losing. Do that in a women, you know, Japanese women wrestler way because just have Sheeta's track record be what you build up. And talk about her and frame her as the wrestler of this era, and then everything else that happens sort of underneath leading to one challenger emerging takes on more relevance. And I think you can do that too, but I think they think that's what they're doing. I just think they could do a better job emphasizing Sheeta on a regular basis and keeping her on people's minds as what everyone is aiming for. Tony
Khan owes a great debt to Shida, because when the pandemic set in and they lost half their women's roster to injuries and travel restrictions, she stepped up and kept it all afloat with when they were in grave danger of not having a women's match on TV every week and or any notable women's feuds. And she stepped up, and she even dealt with like stupid crap like the Abaddon feud, if you remember that one. And, you know, I mean, made it not as embarrassing as it could have been. So bonus points for Shida for her pandemic service.
Anything else for us?
Yeah, what did you make of the the Christian segment today? There was a lot of I'm glad he at least pivoted to, I'm here to win championships. He sort of been saying that after his first promo as well. There's a bit of a mission statement to him now, but I mean, since Taz came out, it just felt like, oh God, okay, here we go. Bingo hall money, your friend carried you, that sort of stuff, just off the cuff, insider comments, all leading to then, Powerhouse Hobbs challenging him, and Powerhouse Hobbs, sorry, he's going to lose next week. It feels like, you know, one of those, it feels like Tony Khan has realized that people aren't as into Christian as much as he's into Christian, so he's trying to build him from the ground up, so to speak.
Yeah, a few weeks ago, I said, you know, Christian seems like the way to introduce Christian and build up his credibility and within the ranking system and with AEW fans is a feud with Team Taz. I mean, it's just, to me, that was the obvious place for him to go. Not that there weren't other options, but that just seemed ready and ripe. And that's where they're going, and I think it's smart. Also, he lightened the F up today. Like, you know, in this promo, he smiled. He put his arm around Tony. He didn't seem super duper uptight with a chip on his shoulder in a way that I thought was off-putting and unlikable. I know he wanted to be seen as something more than a joke and a mid-card guy who's good for a smile. But my God, he just was so uptight and, you know, humorless. And when he smiled, I was like, yes, now here's Christian. This is a guy we like. It's okay to smile and be likable and affable and. So, and then, you know, let the heels, you know, do their work, and they did. I thought that this worked. Eric, what'd you think?
Other than the Jade Cargill match, it might have been my least favorite segment on an otherwise solid show. I think they're just doing a carbon copy of how they booked Sting when he came in. He's shooting with Team Taz. They come out and interrupt him every time you expect you're going to get a big long promo or at least a medium length promo from Christian to explain his mission statement. He gets interrupted just like Team Taz interrupted Sting. That's the promo with all the insider jabs was, you know, very WWE. Look at us, we're shooting, right, back when they would do such things.
Yeah, and you're not going to endear yourself to AEW audience having the baby face say bingo hell derisively. That's a heel line in AEW, not a baby face line.
Yeah, and, you know, I know it's all a work, but I did howl when Christian got off his, I'm glad you're standing on those steps so that I can say this face-to-face. Anytime somebody makes fun of Taz's height, I pop huge for that because
you hate short people.
No, he's just so sensitive about it. I mean, he's always been, right? And so I assume that all of those lines were approved ahead of time with that, but, you know, Taz really sort of delivered a less than optimal thing to get Christian over. I mean, you can say Christian sucks or Christian's past his prime, but instead he said, you know, he didn't name him by name, but he's like, Edge carried you, right? I mean, that's Christian's big Achilles heel is that perception, whereas Taz is his height. But I'm sorry, I think Christian won the promo diss-off just from the get-go. It was a TKO with that line about Taz being short. Love it.
Taz saying I can stand on my wallet and stand 10 feet over you is fine if Christian didn't have a ton of big money earning years in WWE. Like, you can say that about somebody who, you know, comes up through the indies. I'm not sure it resonates with the average viewer watching either. But, yes.
That's also a very much of a Seth Rollins, Will Ospreay on Twitter type thing to say. Yeah.
Yes. Yep. And, I mean, it's a good heel line. It's just I think you save it for somebody where it rings a little more true. I think people probably perceive Christian's bank account having had more funds deposited in it over the past 25 years than Taz. I would bet more people would think that. But still, I think Christian smiling, declaring a mission statement, Yes, it's a rerun of Sting, and Sting they should interrupt because he loses his train of thought on sentence number three or four. Christian could have cut a longer promo. That would have been fine. But this seemed like Christian finally showed up instead of whoever that other guy has been who was just way too self-important and serious and humorless. So I give it a thumbs up, but I do acknowledge, if I'm going to be critical of insider stuff, I certainly am going to be critical of Christian as a babyface taking a dig at the bingo hall. That's what Eric Bischoff says to get heat with the AEW audience. I think that's going to actually really work against Christian with AEW fans if now he's taking shots at ECW. I mean, the AEW logo is inspired in part on ECW's logo. So he's got to kind of read the room a little better, or the writers do, who worked with him, or the producers, and unless they're trying to sabotage him, which I don't think is happening. Cool. Hinton, any closing words?
Yeah, just want to conclude with some thoughts on the Young Bucks. I know you've talked about them a lot, so you may not have much to say in response to this, but, I mean, if you want them to sit down and watch the early 80s promos, I suggest you hear their interview on TSN that they did recently. They don't look like they're going to do that. In fact, if they're going to do it, they're going to do it to mock that entire system. Like, they're so proud of pissing off these sorts of critics, I can tell. And I'm nervous. Like, there's so much good that happened in that match. Like, Matt Jackson doing flip and then the back rake and not following through with the move.
Yes.
That's fine.
Yep.
But then when I see, like, at the end, not the end of the match, but like their promo with the Good Brothers, et cetera, and the goofiness there and them just not taking themselves seriously at all, it tells me that these guys, okay, for the match, they probably sat down, read a textbook, and said, okay, let's do this so that Wade Keller cannot say that. Let's do that so that Wade Keller doesn't say this. Okay, good. Now we've got that done. Now let's get this out of our systems because BT just isn't enough, by God. And I think I'm nervous that we're in tune for more of this going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to build on the positive and hope that the positive can be there in a big enough quantity that some of the other stuff that, like you put it, they need to get out of their system can be present, but it's not the defining trait. It's like I say about Don Callis. I don't mind if there's a little comment to pop the boys in the back on watching on the monitor, or to, tell them over drinks at the bar afterwards, that was great what you said. I couldn't believe you got away with saying that. Like, but don't live for that. Live for selling out crowds. Live for drawing a second million fans by cutting actual money promos. And, the Bucks can have the attitude that they have, and I'm going to respond to the product they put forth on television and make my best case for what I think will serve Tony Khan the most, which, by the way, means serving the wrestling fans the most, because the more fans watching, generally, unless it's just marketing gimmickry, that means they're more happy with the product. And, if the Bucks are on principle against it, I just want to compliment the stuff that I think is working, and I want to point to evidence when it seems like it is, and maybe that will, lead them down a road where it's not some sort of dig your heels in on some philosophy over competing eras or competing visions. Eric, your thoughts on what Hint brought up?
I mean, I think the Young Bucks, you could do a whole podcast psychoanalyzing the Young Bucks and going match by match and bit by bit and era by era. But, I mean, they owe AEW's existence. They met a lot of fans at indie shows, and they took their time to shake your hand, take the selfie. They wrote about it in their book, right? They were poor. They were broke. Then they started selling T-shirts. And they were aware the whole time they owe what they have due to the support of the fans. And then when they got on the big stage in the big U.S. platform, all of a sudden they started getting criticized, possibly for the first time in a major way. They left Twitter, right? They did their inside pot shots at and Twitter's a toxic place, don't get me wrong. They're probably a lot more mentally healthy and sane for not being on Twitter all day. But they started sort of internalizing and taking some of the fans' criticism, and why did you guys put over a Private Party on the first night? You should have booked yourself. And they made it part of BTE every week and started complaining and just came across as a bit thin-skinned. And it's hard to tell with all of the irony and the six levels of insiderness and the irony, how much of this is a work and how much of it is a shoot and how much of it is a combo platter.
Yeah.
But it's sort of always been there. And fingers crossed that they picked a lane and they're going to stick with it and keep the insider terms to a minimum going forward. So Wade can like them again.
Well, we're on the same page. I mean, that's the approach. And I you know, yes. I don't want to repeat myself too much. I think this was a good week for the Bucks. I don't expect them to cleanse themselves of everything that they built their identity around. And again, you said, Eric, you could psychoanalyze them. And I try to pick my spots to psychoanalyze because you can be wildly wrong, you know, with conjecture on what's going on in people's head. And I don't like to assume motive. I prefer to evaluate the finished product. That said, I do wonder if the Bucks are insecure about if they can survive out there as a top act, not leaning on what brought them attention in the first place. And I all I'm saying is I think they're good enough.
Yeah,
I think
agreed.
They truly are good enough. So
they certainly can.
I don't want this to turn into dig your heels in. We're on opposite sides philosophically, and it's a battle to the death over, you know, the Bucks are good enough. They really are, and they showed it tonight. So at their own pace, at their own comfort level, experience that they're good enough not to have to do the insider stuff to pop the boys in the back, to pop the social media, to have the kind of bubble that you know you can kind of live in, praise you enough for things that aren't actually the most important things. And so I'm hoping for that. It's a larger stage. It's a growing process. And I thought tonight was a good step in the right direction to clean up some of what we hope. I just say clean up. It's what we hoped was going to come out of last week. You know, Javier was on with Zach last week and Tyler and yes, it was. Hopefully this is finally a turn. And then if it is, I'm for it. If it's not, I'm completely done with them. You know, so we got Javier coming up in a minute. He can clarify and frame his comments better than I just did if I didn't do it well. Hinton, I appreciate all your topics and everything you contributed. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, everyone, go VIP. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, Hinton. Yep. PWTorch.com/goVIP. We'd love to have you immerse yourself in all of our content, including these shows with the ads and plugs removed. All right. Believe it or not, 781, try it again. Third time's the charm, right? Third time is the charm. 781, please state your name and where you're calling from.
Hey, can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we sure can.
Oh, okay, thank God. This is Bryant Coleman. This is Bryant Coleman from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hey, Brian, good to hear from you. Thanks for calling. Are you an NXT viewer who watched Dynamite?
No, I stopped watching. I watched WWE since 2002, and I stopped watching in 2018 after they did Saudi Arabia after the Khashoggi killing. That was a step too far for me, so I don't watch them anymore. Maybe when Vince McMahon's not in power anymore. So, but
Linda McMahon heading up Donald Trump's nonprofit. That news didn't bring you back today.
No. Yeah, Donald Trump is a thing of the past, thank goodness. But I wanted to bring attention a little bit to the women's division. I just think AEW's chief problem, besides the fact that they have way too many factions that ruin way too many storylines, is their lack of focus. And I feel like this week illustrated that because, you know, you had two matches, one with Chris Statlander and, you know, I don't want to sound kind of prissy here, but a jobber for all intents and purposes. And Chris Statlander, in my opinion, is wildly overrated. She's a known botch artist, and she also injured Britt Baker along with Hikaru Shida when they did that, when they dumped Nyla Rose on her back. I think it was March, if I'm not mistaken. So I really don't understand the focus around her. She's not. I really don't care about her or her story, and she's not a terribly good wrestler either. And Jade Cargill and Red Velvet, the cake, I guess. Red Velvet's okay, but Jade Cargill really does nothing for me. She can't cut a promo. she may be on roids. At least that's just my thought, because her body looks all out of proportion. But those two were involved in a feud that really wasn't done very well at all, and a lot of people, including myself, don't care about. And I just think when you have women like, you know, Thunder Rosa or Riho, or Britt Baker or Sheeta, or even Allie, a.k.a. the Bunny. I don't like calling her the Bunny. I just think they should be focusing more on those core women and not distracting, you know, with two basically crappy match, two crappy women's matches that really do nothing. I mean, case in point, the last week when they had Ty Conti versus Allie, they could have had a really good match if left to their own devices. But again, like the whole faction thing with Dark Order and Matt Hardy's group, they came in and ruined what really could have been a good match. I mean, that match was ruined for me. And I just think that kind of goes into the bigger picture that Tony Khan is in over his head. He really doesn't know how to book very well. He lets the execs, Kenny and the Bucks, and not so much Cody, because Cody actually knows what he's doing, but Kenny Omega does not know how to book a women's division, and I'm far from the only person to say that. I just think Tony Khan needs to realize that he needs help booking and to bring in somebody, not Jim Cornette, because that guy has all sorts of issues, but you know, somebody like a Dutch Mantel or somebody who actually knows how to book and, you know, can bring focus back to it, because this reminds me a lot. AEW right now, I mean, I love it, or at least I try to, you know, and I'll keep watching, but it reminds me a lot of WCW back in the late 90s, the early 2000s, where you had so many factions, a lack of focus, matches that were just so riddled with interference that they really didn't mean much. And I just think AEW is good, but it could be much better. And I think Tony Khan needs to realize that he needs help, particularly with the women's division. And firing Kenny Omega as the head of that division would be a great start.
Brian, I mean, I think you summed up the non-fawning objective critique. It's, I guess, subjective critique, but objective in the sense of, you know, you're not just going in predisposed to forgive the faults and sing the praises of the strengths out of proportion. I think the women's division has been obviously a weak spot for AEW, and it should be of concern to Tony Khan. I do think Chris Statlander's overrated. I thought her high kick to the head looked awful, slow-mo. It's not a good move, and she keeps doing stuff like that. The pile driver was 4 inches off from looking like it had any impact. That finished things off. I mean, yeah, I'd like to see her get better. You know, get some reps on Evolution and Dark. And, you know, but, yeah. So, I mean, I think Tony would benefit from, at some point, bringing, you know, an assistant booker in who he trusts, who has a different vision, who he will not talk at or talk, but will listen to and look at it as taking his booking knowledge to the next level and balance it out a bit. I mean, I think there's room for it. I don't want awards and buy rates and demo ratings and cable rankings to go to his head in the sense that he doesn't stay humble enough to know that with a platform and the talent and the resources he has, there probably are other philosophies and experienced wrestling minds who can help steer him in a more polished, disciplined way towards greater success without changing at the core the DNA of who he is, what his vision is, and what he wants AEW to be. Eric, your thoughts?
Tony Khan was voted Booker of the Year by the Wrestling Observer newsletter readers, so I don't know what you guys are talking about. Everything's fine. Mm-hmm. Sarcasm aside, the factions, I think Todd Martin set Wade Keller pretty straight on that within the last week or two on The Fix. Todd gave a far more eloquent rebuttal to that than I could. The women's division, it's going to sound like I'm making a...
Eric, it was not that long ago. What was the best point about all but three wrestlers in a company being in a faction. What was the best rebuttal that's okay? That stuck with you?
You know, it's his top specific arguments are lost to the sands of time. but I just know that you ended up sort of eating a little bit of crow at the end of that segment. I felt tonally, right? That's what stuck with me was the tone of what happened. Maybe not exactly what
Todd
said.
Gotcha.
The women's division. So they had a thin roster to begin with that was greener than the men's and tag team divisions part of the roster. Then they got hit with a pandemic, so the best parts of the, you know, best workers in the women's division, a lot of them were overseas and unavailable. They couldn't bring people in for, you know, long arcs. And then they had injuries. Britt, Chris, Swole, who they pushed last year, even though she's still somewhat green, she had her health problems. And they did the best they could. They brought in Serena Deeb and Thunder Rosa to improve things, and they're starting to get back to a fuller roster. And Chris Dantlander doesn't do a lot for me. I was there live at the Revolution pay-per-view at the in 2020 in Chicago, where Chris Dantlander had her match against Nyla Rose, and oof, that one was hard to watch in person, probably on TV as well. I guess I'd give them a grade of incomplete so far, as opposed to an F for failure. And I think we'll find out for sure whether this is going to be a chronic problem that they just can't fix this year as they get back up to full staffing and they can mix and match Serena Deeb, Thunder Rosa, Britt Baker, maybe Riho. I don't know if she's still around or if she's back in Japan, and Shida and maybe Conti, right? That's not a terrible core roster to work with, and they're going to continue to push Jade Cargill, whether we like it or not, or think she needs more seasoning. But this is probably never going to be All Japan Women Wrestling in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, I think what I'm in search for is just a sense of hierarchy and distinct personality. So I kind of understand who, you know, we know who Britt Baker is. And we know Reba/Rebel is her sidekick. We know Hikaru Shida is a world-class athlete at the top of her game, who's a champion. Who else do we know? Jim Ross has mocked the alien gimmick and the bopping nonsense that belongs on indie shows in front of 150 people. What else do we know about the baby faces and even Red Velvet? Like, what do we know about them that defines their characters? I think the men, we've got a pretty good idea, with just about everybody. You know, there's distinct personalities where you look at them and you go, all right, I associate this with this person. I see what drives them. I kind of get a sense of what kind of person they are, whether it's Darby or Sammy Guevara or Chris Jericho or Lance Archer. Is there enough of that in the way the women are booked, or are they booked out? Are they booked because, wow, look, let Excalibur tell you what they did in Japan, or wow, look at the high spot that they were able to do in almost a patronizing way. That can you believe she was able to do that? I want to see more personalities established as part of the booking. That's what you do on a weekly wrestling series, as opposed to, you know, booking around big shows overseas, which is done more often overseas.
I mean, they get a 2-hour show each week that the 1 2-hour network TV show. And for the longest time, when they had NXT competition and roster, they had one woman's match a week, right? And it was super inconsistent. And tonight we saw two women's matches. Maybe we'd like those women's matches.
Yeah.
But if you keep giving the women at bat, I would think you'll see improvement eventually and maybe build some angles around them and mix and match a little better than they have.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, I mean, the issue is just with the TV time they've given them, they've had injuries and setbacks in a pandemic. I'm accounting for that as part of grading on a curve, I guess. But with that TV time, I feel like there's been, when they focused on something, I've taken away the focus of the things I listed in my question. Oh, her accolades from Japan, or look at that great move, or look at this indie-rific gimmick. And I just don't think a lot of time was put in to go, how is this person going to connect with an audience in a way that's going to make them look up to them, buy their merchandise, root for them on their journey, or root against them? I just don't think there's been enough of that. And I don't know that that even enters their mind as something that they should be doing as part of booking characters on a weekly wrestling TV series. I think they come from a different culture that doesn't work particularly well. It doesn't translate well to a two-hour show weekly on TNT. I don't see that approach being taken with enough of the women, enough of the women's division. Erica, you were, are you there? Yeah, I heard a little bit of distortion, so I wasn't sure if you're still there. So, Brian, we'll go back to you for any closing words here. We want to kind of move through the last calls here a little quicker than we have been.
Sure. I'll just end with this point. I think there was a – back when Deonna Purrazzo was let go by NXT and there was a chance to sign her, Kenny Omega did not make much of an effort to sign her. And you know, he was criticized for that, and he didn't take the criticism very well. And, you know, that goes back to my point that he's not a very good booker for the women's division because with the with the tournament – he could have built up Britt Baker or Ty Conti, but instead, you know, he just had another Japanese woman that, you know, and I hate to sound callous here, but no one in the United States really cares about Japanese women wrestlers for the most part, because like the only Japanese woman wrestler who's had major success here in like the last 30 years has been Asuka, and, you know, Ryo Mizunami is not Asuka, to say the least. But I'll close with the point that I think that AEW should go after Tessa Blanchard, because I know there's a lot of controversy surrounding her and things like that, and I'm not saying that the accusations don't have merit, but I think it's kind of suspicious that all the allegations came out against her right when she was about to win the Impact World title. So I think you have to factor in the timing of that. So I'm somewhat doubtful that those allegations are true to some extent. So, and I just think she, her charisma, her skill would bring a lot to the table in terms of the women's division, you know, and if they're worried about her being a problem backstage, her father could probably, be sort of a guiding force for her. I just think if they went after her or Thea Trinidad, it could really do some good. And I'll just close with that point.
Sure. I appreciate it, Brian. Thanks. Anything you want to add, Eric, to any of that?
I'd be a hard no on Tessa Blanchard. I guess, you know, in the case of Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby and certain former presidents, when one or two people say something about you, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true. When a whole bunch of people say stuff about you, it's all kind of the same thing. I think that tends to add to the credibility of the allegations against you. And there's a good reason that Tessa Blanchard hasn't even been touched by WWE, who was willing to put Matt Riddle on TV with a push, despite the lawsuit that was filed against him. That's when you're accused of using the N-word, in a women's locker room, I think it was in Japan, right? That's a hard one to overcome in 2021 in U.S. society. I imagine both companies have said just not worth the headache.
Yeah. I think there's a body of evidence that you can exclude one or two or three things as sort of a mulligan or what if it's not true, and still have a pile of things that are concerning. And there's people who know more, people who know more specifics than I do and you do, Eric, who also are saying, so talented, but it just, you can't, you know, you just can't bring that toxic history and a lack of a sense of growth or you know, I mean, it's not about canceling her forever. It's a lot of this. It's like with Hogan, you know, just give us an apology that feels sincere and that seems to be grounded in some sort of, you know, different place that you're in and you're in the way that you look at the world and that you've learned and there's real regret. And, you know, that moment needs to come and then a couple more years needs to go by. And then, you know, we can start talking about, you know, whether people in the business, we'll start hearing people in the business maybe going, now it's time to reconsider.
And what happened to Hulk Hogan last weekend in his hometown? He was booed.
Yes. Eric, you're starting to break up a little bit. Internet-wise, I don't know if you moved around or if there's something you can do, but you're starting to sound a little like Max Headroom, to use a a dated reference there for the
I will wait. I will move the microphone closer to my mouth. Maybe is that better?
Yeah, it's well, we'll see. It sounds more like internet interference of some kind, but but maybe that'll help. All right, let's move on here to let's see who's up next. Alex in Montreal. Alex, go ahead and tell us what you thought of Dynamite tonight.
Hey, Wade. I really love the show tonight. I have to say, from top to bottom, I thought it was really exciting. I thought it moved really, really well. And it felt like a really nice reset from the very first segment with the Bucks, whose story I really haven't been a fan of, quite honestly. How they got here was really sloppy, but
yeah.
The way they kind of just hammered it home today by saying, clearly, we are heels, we are aligned with this faction, this is what we are going to do moving forward, we're the best tag team in the world, screw everybody, we're going to prove everybody wrong once again. I'm on board, basically. So, and I knew this was going to happen. Like when that angle happened to end the show last week, I was like, here we go. Like, it was like a turn too far. You know, it could have been like the name of their story, basically. But this time, like, they brought it all together. And what I really want to talk about today is actually the connective tissue of this show, the way that they slowed it down and emphasized again and again the importance of championships. You had various performers throughout the show talking about the importance of titles and wanting to go after titles, like Christian and Miro and Thunder Rosa. And I'm sure there were other people. But
and all the tag teams scouting the Young Bucks match. I mean, in its own way, that was the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. And it made everything feel important, and it made things feel like it had consequence. I guess another part of that would be that there weren't as many, unranked wrestlers on this show, except for, you know, maybe the Statlander match, which was kind of just a welcome back squash for her, which was, I was all for. I love seeing Statlander back. I thought she looked really good. But getting back to this connective tissue idea. So you start the show with the Young Bucks promo. Then you go into the Young Bucks match. Right after the Young Bucks match, you go to the back where you have Marvez talking with Hangman and the Dark Order, getting his reaction to everything that's going on with them. And then later on in the show, you go back and you talk to the Elite as a unit, talking, providing even more context about this match that we watched tonight, about the alliance with Don Callis, what they're doing moving forward. So I really liked that.
And Kenny's saying where we go, gold follows, you know, like playing on your theme or, you know, Alex, what you picked up on the connective tissue, you know, where we go, you know, gold follows, whatever, however he phrased it, even that was the champion talking about championships and coveting them and always collecting belts.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that I really liked was how heavily the women were featured tonight. And this also goes back to this connective tissue idea of you had Red Velvet and Jade have a match. And right after the match, you go back, you go to the back, you have Britt Baker, and she is talking about the rankings and how she's moving up in the rankings and how she also mentions the match that just happened and the consequences of Red Velvet losing potentially for the rankings. And she mentions Sheeta and she mentions Ty Conti. And hey, what do you know? Later in the show, you have Ty Conti and Sheeta get a little promo package for a match that they're going to have next week for the championship. So I really liked how they were interweaving all of these title challengers. You see what's coming up, you know, a month from now. You kind of have the seeds planted for the pay-per-view already, and you see the steps that they need to take before they get to the final destinations, which we know we're going to get to eventually. And I don't even mind the predictability of it. Like, I know eventually it's going to be Britt versus Sheeta, and Britt is probably going to win the title at the pay-per-view. But I'm also really excited for this Ty Conti and Hikaru Shida match next week, which has the potential to, you know, have a couple of women just kneeing the hell out of each other. So I was just really, really satisfied with the show today, mostly for those reasons. Just everything felt important and everything felt like it had consequence. I mean, I don't want to say everything. I mean, obviously there's probably some things I can point to and nitpick, but overall, like, I was incredibly satisfied with the show tonight for those reasons.
Alex, we've been dissecting the Bucks, and you started talking about them, and it's been about, you know, stay focused on, you know, wrestling storyline, developing your character, stay away from the meta, the insider stuff, or do it in small enough doses where it doesn't seem like it's a primary thing you're grading yourself on at the end of the night. Let me look at another angle about this. What was, let's say the Bucks didn't do anything ironic and never have. This was just a storyline after a promo after a heel turn. And they're explaining why they chose to go with Callis and Kenny. Did their explanation, and Eric, I want to get your take on this after I ask Alex, was their explanation enough? Or is it sort of begging the question? You know, we chose friendship. Well, no, the question is, why did you choose to be friends with them? Oh, we chose friendship. That's the definition of begging the question. You're answering the question by restating the question. Did we get enough from them to explain this long, sort of bumpy, uneven journey we've been on with them? Is there more to be told and extracted from the story that they told where we might look back and go, oh, all those chapters that we saw, or at least a lot more of them, actually kind of fall into place in a way where now I disagree, I don't like them over, but I understand why they chose to align mm-hmm. with Moxley and Callis, I'm sorry, Omega and Callis again, as opposed to staying loyal to Moxley and Hangman Page and Cody or just ourselves and our family. your thoughts on that, Alex, and then Eric.
Sure. I think they did a decent job. I mean, outside of, again, the road they took to get here was really sloppy. The execution of the segments of Matt Jackson trying to act and seem dramatic when Don Callis slaps him and is telling him that he doesn't have it anymore and that these are not the same Young Bucks that I saw in New Japan. And the explanation of, you know, we chose friendship, and then saying also that Don Callis was right, that, you know, we basically got a bit too comfortable and we got a little too high on ourselves, essentially, and we forgot who we were. And it took Don Callis kind of smacking Matt Jackson around, I suppose, to kind of wake him up to that. The way they got there was really, really sloppy, but the explanation itself does work in a vacuum for me. it's not just friendship.
Yeah.
It's also Callis being the invisible hand, I guess, or very visible in the case of, you know, him confronting Matt Jackson and kind of telling him, hey, where have you guys been? You guys have changed. And it basically comes down to you changed, man. And then Matt Hardy just saying, yeah, we have Matt Hardy. Who am I talking about? Matt Jackson saying, you know what? Yeah, we have changed and it hasn't been for the better. And I don't like who I am kind of when I look at myself in the mirror, or I didn't like who I was anymore when I looked at myself in the mirror. So I think it works in a vacuum. And if you can kind of just forget everything that came before and give them a clean slate with this.
And that's what I led the show is all well that ends well. Are we at a good enough place? We can sort of forgive, give a mulligan, you know, just conveniently forget some of the missteps that they were trying to carve their path. Figure out their way, but, you know, to acknowledge we took a big payday and we're no longer hungry, that match is what we watched for 18 mm-hmm. months. They were happy to get a 4.5-star match now and then and hang their hat on their ability to do that, but they didn't seem hungry to establish themselves with, introduce themselves and expand their characters in a way that would, you know, draw the so-called second million, the proverbial second million fans, expand their audience. And then they turned to saying we sat idly by and let others take credit for the work they did. I'm not quite sure, you know, I have to kind of process it more. I'm not quite sure how that fits into we weren't hungry and we took a big payday. We also sat back and let others take credit. I think they're sort of throwing things out there that they've been criticized for and sort of saying, yeah, maybe it's true, but who cares? Now we're bad guys. Eric, how about you?
Well, Wade, let's correct the record. They had a 6-star match at Revolution 2020 against Adam Page and Kenny Omega, not a 4.5-star match.
That's a very key detail.
But that's just me coloring outside the lines here. Yeah, I mean, there is no way to explain the bumpy ride. This was not the end of the usual suspects when Kaiser Soze is revealed and the cop who's been interrogating him for 2 hours puts all the pieces together and drops his coffee cup and Kaiser Soze walks out of the police station and stops his limp, right? spoiler alert, I get that that movie's so old. This was, they had a bumpy ride. They figured the best way out of it. It wasn't, I thought the Young Bucks' inability to act, you know, and emote, especially Nick, made this more difficult than it otherwise would be. If you watched BTE last week, they had this video montage with stills and some old video of the Kenny and Young Bucks, you know, buddy times from before that really filled in a lot of the backstory if you didn't know it. Now, unfortunately, the people who all watch BTE already know the backstory and didn't really need that. It was the people on Dynamite who needed the why they're such good friends part to be filled in. But
if you're transferring a book to a movie and you're confused watching the movie and the person goes, oh, they covered that in the book, they whisper that to you, that doesn't make the movie better.
No, it's not great storytelling. But no. You know what? I'm on team, give them a fresh start,
right.
And hope they improve going forward in that arena. And they did give us how many stars did you rate the tag team title match tonight, Wade? I mean, they did give us a 4-star-plus match, probably 4.5 stars. You tend to be stingier than most with star ratings, so.
Yeah, I think more accurate is the word you're looking for. I think subtracting 1 to 1.5 stars. What was that?
That was a 4.25 for me. It was really good, though.
Okay.
Yeah, I think 4.25 is – I think 4.5 is a little more special for me than and a little more rare than it is for others. There's certain people I look at their star rating and I subtract 3/4 stars. I'm like, there, that's the scale. And sometimes 1 star, or 1.25. I mean, it's not a science, but, I try to be consistent in my own subjective structure and that's 4, 4.25, 4.5 is, it doesn't mean it doesn't happen very often, but, it doesn't happen very often. but star ratings, I think get kind of silly to talk about too much. Alex, anything else you want to, I guess I'll round this back to my question to you and Eric was more, as much as we praise what they did and it's fresh start and it's great, was there a missed opportunity to hone in a little bit more on Dynamite in a way that would have brought some of the unevenness and the things that they covered in being the Elite into that time that they had in that promo? Was there a way to spend that time a little bit better to have people at home go, oh, screw them. You know, like now I really understand where they're coming from and why they did what they did. And I'm not quite sure it hit that level of you know, home run promo. But the effect was we're heels and we're going to be obnoxious and we're aligned with this guy who you don't like. And now line up the baby faces and boo us. And that is, you know, 80% of the game. Alex, any closing words or follow-up?
No, I just want to say thank you for doing the show. And I thought it was a really good show tonight, and I'm looking forward to more next week.
Cool. Thanks, Alex. Appreciate it.
Take care, guys.
All right. Take care. Yep. All right. We'll go next to Nick in Brattleboro. Nick, we are running long, so don't add to that too much. Yeah, we covered a lot already, though, so go ahead.
Yeah. You covered most of my points. The main big thing I'll say is I've mostly been an AEW watcher, not an NXT watcher, but I did watch NXT last night, and both shows I think are actually going to really benefit from not being head-to-head. Yes, it was cool, the Wednesday Night Wars and all that, but both shows seem to slow down like 20%. And made the show better just because you could get immersed in the show and not be like flipping to the next thing, the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And I thought I thought both shows really benefited from not having to outdo the other guy.
I was thinking that during the show, Eric. What do you think the effect is going to be for AEW? Tony studied the minute by minutes on Fridays, you know, and they went to break, you know, sometimes the announcer go, well, we're going to go to a break. And then they won't go to break for 2 minutes because I'm assuming Tony's watching on the monitor going, well, we can't go to break yet because NXT, you know, hasn't gone to their break yet or, you know, whatever his strategy was. Some of that obviously is going to change when they're you know, they're not going to be worried about that. But do you think there will be changes beyond sort of that kind of, you know, little mini strategies to try to game the system in a micro way, and in a macro way, maybe be more patient with some of the matches or some of the storylines, and not have that frenetic sense of urgency that we're going to lose someone if we air a video package, God forbid, they're going to go watch something live on NXT.
Yeah, right. I think that benefits AEW. I never got the sense NXT was really counter-programming as much as Tony Khan was in that second-by-second way. And
almost
and,
pridefully so.
Right.
You know, like, and, I mean, even last night, it was like they picked up where we left out. We're not, they didn't even like reintroduce the concept, the show and the wrestlers like, hey, we, you know, like to sort of acknowledge there's new people watching. And Triple H even said, we're too busy doing our thing to worry about that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, their biggest counter move was their branding, right? They declared a show Halloween Havoc just for the hell of it, right? Because it has some brand value still.
I think they wanted to be able to look back at everything that they did booking wise and the big matches and go, if Dynamite never existed, not a single thing would have been different, which is BS. But I think they booked and marketed themselves in a way where they wanted to have that as some sort of plausible framing of their booking, because, you know, they just didn't want to come across as if they were desperately trying to win something that they were not winning.
As for going forward, I mean, you saw it tonight, more video packages, a less frenetic pace. There were times when I felt the show was kind of dragging, like when they went, you know, the Anthony Ogogo squash match. You know, they had that great opening match, and then it kind of dragged for a little bit till they got to Jericho Harwood and then picked up again. So I always got the sense Tony Khan is super worried about burning through too many high-profile matches on TV and not having enough that feel special for pay-per-view. That, you know, if you're not going head-to-head, there's less pressure, unless ratings fall, to hotshot a bunch of marquee matches on TV every week and still put on an entertaining show, which I think they have a pretty good track record on that. Looking ahead at next week's lineup, Shida Conti, they've been building that for a while, but it's not like Shida Britt. You're not giving that match away on TV, right? It's more of an interim type challenger between pay-per-views. Hobbs, Christian Cage, they set that up tonight. So Ricky Starks versus Hangman Page, that doesn't really seem to have a reason for being other than like it's a ranking system battle.
Which is good. Let's have more of that. Not every match has to have a storyline or argument preceding it.
It seems to me they're building Paige up the whole year, and they built Max Caster up as the number three guy, right, in the rankings a couple weeks ago, and then fed him to Paige. Seems like they're doing the same thing with Starks. And then Trent and Penta, at least it should be a good match, and at least it was set up last week, I think, when the Best Friends came out to confront them. So none of those matches by themselves are like maybe appointment television. I mean, they could announce other stuff, I suppose. They're back live next week, so they've got six more days as of tomorrow to do that. But if everything breathes and they follow up on the angles they set up in a more consistent fashion, maybe because they're not worried about minute-by-minute ratings as much, yeah, you'll start to see the quality improve. As for me as a fan, selfishly, I'm really grateful that I watch NXT for 2 hours and I'm exhausted because of the breakneck pace, and then I go kind of fast forward through NXT. Now I can just enjoy NXT and watch it unfold at the pace that it does.
Triple H mentioned in the media call that we ran on the show last week, not, you know, like his philosophy on booking and the cadence of the week-to-week weekly series is like a TV series. You know, I don't know if he brought up Walking Dead or Breaking Bad or maybe something else, maybe all of the above. But he says, you know, not every show is meant to be the most blockbuster, praiseworthy, buzz-generating show. You know, some shows are there to lay the foundation, explore a character, bring things down a level. And it's the same psychology of a three-hour wrestling event. You know, not every match is a failure if it's not four stars. If the goal of the match was to forward a certain character and tell a certain story and also know its place on the card to have an ebb and a flow in terms of audience energy and not doing a bunch of kickouts. If you're trying to make a bunch of kickouts in big spots mean more later, you don't burn the crowd on it earlier. And I don't know that a lot of fans, and I don't even know that some bookers and wrestlers have even think about it in those terms, but Triple H was communicating that that's how we book our weekly TV series. You know, not every week is meant to be takeover quality, but we have a built in base and audience, and we want to make their 2 hours worth tuning in, but you're not always going to get, you know, pay-per-view caliber matches. And I think we might see more of that with Tony. And I think Tony's had that approach to a degree too. You know, and I think he's intentionally built up different matches to headline and different wrestlers. And I think it's one of the strengths of AEW is not every week, The main segments aren't always built around the same, you know, two people. There's times with WWE TV over the years, even the void of time that you missed, Eric, where it was like every, like 7 out of 8 weeks, the same 2, 3, 4 people were in a main event because they hadn't built anyone else up where they could trust they could put them in the main event. With the TNT title and the women's division and the tag division and grudge matches, AEW's mixed it up. So I think Tony will feel comfortable dialing it down a little bit more, but I think he's always been cognizant of the negative of hot shotting in a without an eye on without playing long ball and thinking long term. Let's see, Nick, what else have you got for us?
Just quick, first of all, I thought the Mike Tyson punch was, man, that looked stiff, but it was really interesting is that when the Pinnacle was on the floor and the Inner Circle was in the ring. Who's MJF's guy, big guy?
Wardlow
had the guy in a fireman's carry, like he was still out cold, which was just a great little touch that, you know, if you're noticing it, it added a little salt and pepper to the show. Thing I just wanted to say is give me some more Layla Hirsch and Anna Jay when she gets healthy. And also I was listening to your VIP hotlines, and I heard that you got your first shot. Congratulations. I'm getting my second tomorrow. And with that, I will let the Old Man Curmudgeon Wrestling Club sail off into the sunset tonight.
Thanks, Nick. Always good to hear from you. Take care. All right, let's wrap up here with Javier, who's been patiently on hold, listening to us cover almost all of his topics. But as always, Javier, you've got more for us.
Hey, Wade. Hey, Eric. How's it going?
Hey.
Good.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty good show. It was taped, correct? Which pretty much is par for the course lately.
Yep. Yeah. Tony rewatches and edits and rewatches and edits these pre-tape shows. I mean, it is the stone cutter version of his booking when you see the tape shows when he has 6 days to work on them.
Yeah, and I love the opening promo because after you've brought me up so many times this week over the what I said about the Bucks, I'm like, if they're faces again or wishy-washy again, I'm probably never going to hear the end of it.
I think what you just said was, it's not so much giving you a hard time as much as you were like, I'm on board as long as this is what it appears to be. But if it's another swerve, screw them, I'm done. And I think a lot of people feel that way about that. Yeah.
I mean, and it's not to say that I need them to be heels from now to like 10 years from now or whatever. But at least they have agency as opposed to just reacting wishy-washy. If it turns out like 6 months from now, this was all, whatever story they're trying to tell, that's fine. At least they have agency. They're direct and they're the ones pushing the story along now. Although considering the kind of the back seat that they took at that promo, the final promo that they did, and they kind of took like a backseat to Callis and Omega. I don't think that that's the plan, and if it is, it's going to be pretty bad. But now that they have charted a course, I got the feeling that now Hangman Page is off course, because when Alex Marvez asked him about the what's going on with the Elite, he kind of dodged the question and bailed on the interview. Looking rather uncomfortable. So maybe we're going to be getting a wishy-washy Hangman Page now.
Yeah, Eric, what did you make of Page? What story are they telling or trying to tell with him when he just tells an egg rolls joke or whatever it was and wanders off with Dark Order after swigging a beer.
I liked where Javier was going with that. I had a what-if scenario brainstorm as soon as I saw that and saw the rest of the Bucks promos. The conventional wisdom has been that they were going to eventually at some point reunite the Elite as baby faces and they would take their rightful place as the stars of the show. And what if they're going to do that, but they're going to reunite the Elite as heels? Hangman is the last piece of that puzzle. And then I kind of thought, well, that might be interesting. It sure as heck seems like they're doing with Hangman Page what WWE did with Bobby Lashley for a year. He's not losing. They're building him up. I assume he is the November challenger for Kenny Omega at Full Gear. It is my assumption, and possibly, depending on how things go, maybe they put the title on him. I think Hangman will benefit like Orange Cassidy from when there are crowds back and Hangman can do his Stone Cold Steve Austin gimmick with the beer and the being the cowboy. And I think that's where it's headed, but that certainly is a route they could go. I chalked up tonight's not wanting to answer the question as him as just that uncomfortableness. Doesn't want to go back. Doesn't want to comment yet.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to say yet, Javier, because it's a small sample of whatever story they're telling with them. I mean, Eric is right. I mean, until crowds are back, I almost feel like they're sort of spinning wheels on purpose with him because they don't want to go too far until the crowd is reacting, an actual full house audience. But I don't love the presentation blowing off the interview and seeming like he's not really focused when he's last week is moving into top contendership suddenly.
Yeah, that was my take, because he looked like he was riding the ship, more confident, with the friendship he struck up with the Dark Order, but now him going back to what is it they were calling him, Millennial Cowboy, I think, was what they were calling him, something along those lines. But I don't want him to go back to the, having all this angst about, what his former friends are doing. And if they do, just do it like super briefly and then, have to draw a line in the sand and choose a side. So that was on that. And the other thing on the Young Bucks I had, because you mentioned about them showboating, but that was kind of like their gimmick, was the fact that they were so good that the only way they would lose is that they'd start showboating too much and that's what would cost them, or they'd become so reckless in their offense that they started hurting each other. So I kind of like that version of them when they were, early on in the early Bucks before, the crowd turned them face. I like that whole idea that they were their own worst enemies, was kind of like the way that they had been booked.
And I like that too. I just think they got to that line and told that story, and then he dropped to his knees and fake cried. Like, I just thought it was one. Just save that for a different match. It just was a little too much. It's that fourth adjective, and three were sufficient in a sentence, or two, or one. Yeah. Anyway, you got my point.
Yeah. And Eric, I had written, I don't know what you had written. I forgot what you had written, but I had written, the chair-assisted twist of fate was a kick out with a question mark.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
Cause I mean, I'm okay with the jump out, through the table, being a kick out a little bit later on. It was just that one was, it's his finisher and it's assisted. The last time I saw something that egregious was Roman Reigns powering out of Rusev's the camel clutch thing that he had, on stairs with an iron chain, and Roman Reigns powered out of it. That could totally, that's what made me hate Roman Reigns at that point. It was the same thing,
yeah.
Like, I know they're calling Darby Allin indestructible and stuff, but that was kind of, finisher with a, with, with a, where the chair was, that was a bridge too far. But if I turn off my brain, I did enjoy the match.
Booker should not take pride in people saying, if I turn off my brain, .. You know, your goal should not be, that is the only way people can enjoy your booking. But I you know, yes, at least there's something there if you do turn off your brain to like. And that is a consolation prize.
Well, that in movies, because that's pretty much what a lot of people who push back on some of the critiques of, you know, everybody's favorite movies, like, oh, well, if I turn off my brain, I enjoy it. But you shouldn't have to do that. Same thing with wrestling. I think same thing with, you know, all entertainment. You should never turning off your brain should never be a prerequisite for you enjoying something.
I love Kevin Sullivan's line. It's W.C.W. Booker when people were critical of something he was doing, and he goes, you have to suspend your disbelief. It's like he didn't even know what that term meant, but he just said it in response to people criticizing something that didn't make any sense. Suspend your disbelief. It's like, I'm not quite sure he gets the spirit of what that phrase means. But nevertheless, Eric?
Guys, sometimes I want to watch Kenneth Branagh adapt a Shakespeare play for the big screen. Sometimes I want to watch Godzilla and King Kong beat the hell out of each other.
Exactly.
It just depends on where I'm at in life at that particular moment in time.
Yep, totally.
And keeping in the main event, it was mentioned a while back that, you know, that they might be relying too much on hardcore and blood and guts. And while this didn't have blood and guts, this has pretty much been a pretty solid slate of shows that's had some sort of, you know, hardcore weapons laden, you know, match in a row. You think that we might be, you know, going a little bit too far?
I mean, it's a theory that's what's actually driving some people away. You know, I mean, the viewership, you know, 768, 757, 700, 688, they've been on a one-month downswing. You know, I mean, Tony will point to demographic numbers and all that, but, I mean, you'd like to see numbers going up, not down, during this stretch of ultra-violence. Erica, what is the, you know, cost-benefit, I guess, of making that a big part of your brand?
Well, there are some analysts out there, maybe they talk to Tony Khan every week, who suggest that it's almost totally the women viewership, right, that's led to this decline and that they were turned off by the Brit Thunder Rosa bloodbath, and so they just checked out or stopped watching. Other people have talked about an MTV reality show cutting into the women audience. I am not a ratings demographic expert and don't get the numbers to look at, but they sure as heck have been down, as you just eloquently pointed out, with actual facts and figures. Where do you set the success failure for the audience this week, the first not head-to-head week? We saw that I don't know when NXT's average, if you throw out the Takeover branding as an outlier, NXT probably had a 200,000 viewer upswing, right? I mean, they were averaging around 600,000 a week, maybe a little bit more.
Yeah, the story I wrote at PWTorch.com earlier broke this down. The average viewership from January 6th through March 31st, reading for my story, was 653,000. So the 805,000 on Tuesday represents a 23% increase. NXT averaged 675,000 in quarter four last year. So in the kind of, you know, taking even a larger sample size, that's where they were coming from. 1 year ago this week, NXT did 694,000, so they're 110,000 above that. It's only 1 week, but AEW Dynamite averaged 775,000 in quarter one. So if they experienced a similar increase in percent, they would end up at 953. If they experienced a similar increase in just sheer number, they'll end up at 915,000.
I bet on the lower end of that. We'll know in less than 24 hours, but I don't know that they get that, you know, my gut just says they don't get that big of a bump, but maybe, I mean, maybe it's just because they've been so low, for a couple weeks now that it seems like to gobble up that many viewers again is, might take them a few weeks to get there. But, I was thinking,
I'm wondering if they said this, I was thinking you gobble up those viewers this week, and then you build on that if the shows are good. like, you know, it's going to take some time for people to kind of recalibrate, or, you know, you watch NXT on a Tuesday and now you're like, oh, that's right, AEW's on Wednesday. I don't normally watch that, but I'm going to give it a try now. I think NXT has more room to grow than AEW because AEW is on their normal night. So I take the higher end of what is the what AEW should consider a success because they're on the same night. NXT didn't have competition. They're coming out of WrestleMania weekend and TakeOver. That worked in their benefit, but they changed nights, and people are creatures of habit. So it's not apples to apples. That's why I think AEW's bar is a little higher.
I mean, to me, 9:15 seems in this week seems like the high end of what they might do. And the 9:50 or more seems maybe out of reach. But, you know, again, does it really matter when you get the +3 and the +7 figures? They're over a million just about every week. So it's just when are you watching it? And you're winning the war on Twitter, I guess, even if you end up at the same place more or less after 7 days anyway.
I think it comes – expectations for rating comes down to, do you think coming off of TakeOver – a new champion, WrestleMania week, and a plug on Raw, and as Triple H keeps saying, only 24 hours instead of 48, you know, from the plug on Raw to people watching. I think he overrates that, but it's a positive spin on moving to Tuesdays. How much is all the positives out? Does that more than offset the negative of changing nights? AEW's on the same night. I think being on the same night means they should increase more than NXT did. And I think anything less than 920 is a disappointment in terms of how many NXT fans they grabbed on week one who tuned in going, oh, that's right, NXT's not on, I'll try AEW. I think AEW should improve upon it because they're on the old night, not a new night. And that's where I think 9:15 is the lowest they should be okay with.
Yeah, I guess to get that, they're getting a ton of NXT folks switching over. Are they regaining the women audience that they seem to have lost a little bit?
Let me push
that's
back.
That's the harder part, right?
If I push back on the women's audience argument, you know, on March 3rd and March 10th, they did in the male 18 to 49, 0.49 and 0.45. In the male 18 to 49 audience. Last 2 weeks, they did 0.38, 0.38. I mean, they're down on men. I don't buy the narrative. I look at the numbers. I don't buy the narrative.
Well, last week they were down just in total viewers a lot, I assume, because of TakeOver. I don't know what was going on the few weeks before that was causing them to lose, who they were losing specifically.
Well, they did 688 last week and 700,000 the week before. Both were way below their average.
Right.
My point is if the idea is, oh, that number is just because we lost women. No, if they did they did 0.40 or higher the previous at least 4 weeks, and they've been under 0.40 in the men demographic the last 2 weeks. So they have also turned off men, not just women. That's my point, is they're losing everybody in this downward trend, not just women. The young male demo has been a little more steady, but they're even down there too. They did 0.17 and 0.17 in mid-March, and they did 0.13 and 0.15 the last 2 weeks in the 18 to 34 demo. So I like larger sample sizes for demos because I think there's more margin for error with smaller sample size. But I'm just not buying the female audience being the only thing that is. It's not like the same number of men are watching and only women have left.
My guess would be that historically it's easier to bring back male viewers than female wrestling viewers because there tend to be fewer of them to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just pushing back on the idea we've only lost women and the men still love us. If that is what is being posited. I am saying the numbers do not back that up. That sounds like an excuse, a selective look at numbers and an excuse. Javier, back to you. What else have you got?
You mentioned the guy, I forgot his name now, Agogo, that knockout thing. The other way that they could have covered for that whole thing would be the commentary, you know, saying that he couldn't answer the refs, you know, when the ref asked him, are you okay? He couldn't answer the ref because you could at least cover it that way. It would have been nice instead of them, you know, making fun of, you know, move names, which happened twice. When I find it aggravating particularly the one where JR got a B in his bonnet about clothesline or lariat. That one annoyed me. And Eric, was the other line you liked from MJF? I was barely born when Tyson had his run, but Dad said he was a big deal. Was that the line?
Yes, that was great as well.
That was great. MJF, wonderful with the insults and his delivery. It's I mean, Tucker Carlson-esque in its artfulness of you know, taking a dig but saying it in such a matter-of-fact way that it doesn't sound like an insult, it sounds like a fact, or it doesn't sound like propaganda, it sounds like a given. And he says it in a way where it's just like, wow. Yeah, he's really good at his craft. I've stopped the show with the Tucker Carlson reference. One other thing I want to bring up about inconsistencies is when Jade Cargill entered, Red Velvet attacked her immediately. And the ref called for the bell to start the match. And WWE's been better about this. It's that, you know, it's a story you want to tell. Who cares about consistency, about how referees act? And if we're picking on referees not being consistent, oh, he got punched in the gut, he looks like he's in pain, I better call off the match. What the F? That never happens. That's just dumb. The ref shouldn't reward a pre-bell attack. When there's a pre-bell attack, you separate the wrestlers and you check with the wrestler who got beat up, like Matt Riddle a couple weeks ago with Sheamus, and Riddle's like, yeah, I'm fine. I can go. Once the person who's the victim of the attack says, okay, then it's not on the ref anymore. The ref can ring the bell. The wrestler got beat up, gave permission. And so there's WWE's far from perfect. It goes without say. But AEW, I wish that there were some things they picked up on that WWE's corrected over time to make things a little more logical in that regard.
Yeah, that just happened on New Japan Strong, where Hikuleo jumped Fred Rosser before the bell started, and they did the same thing. You know, once they got into the ring, they asked, you know, Fred Rosser, and I said, no, I'm good to go, even though he, you know, was still passed out in the corner. But he's as the stalwart babyface, he said he was good to go, and the match started. So I think, like, as far as I can tell, I think, like, everybody does that, so I don't know why AEW doesn't.
Yeah, I know. It's part of where just another voice in the booking room would be good.
And for that opening match, I actually gave it a 3.5. I find it hard to give more than 3.5 to any match on TV when they've got commercial breaks, because it kills the flow for me. So, I enjoyed the match. I think I know who you were referencing to with the star thing.
There's not a ton of people I pay attention to their star ratings, but I'm pretty consistent in subtracting, and one of them's on staff, and I've told them that.
So you think 3.5 fair for me?
I don't think it's fair to take away from a match rating based on a commercial, on a personal level, taking you out of it. I think you almost have to fill in the gap, especially when most of it's on split screen, and I don't give star ratings to TV matches as often, in part because I think the goal of a match on TV is most of the time and ought to be different than a match that exists as not a means to an end, but an end. It's what you bought. It's the end of the end of the journey, or a major chapter, a major pillar in the story. And it's something you pay for, and it's not there to set up an angle. And there are matches that are exceptions on TV, and I will make an exception on them. But as a habit, I just don't. This gets into a much larger discussion, and we've gone two plus hours here. But I don't think the star rating system should apply in the same way to a match on TV as it does on pay-per-view, because a good booker is going to have a completely different purpose to a match on TV than he does at a house show or a pay-per-view. And I think the scale of how you judge it should take that into account.
Pre-taped. I mean, you don't know what they edited out, right?
Yeah, in that sense, you just go, I'm judging the final product. You know, I mean, if they took out 12 minutes and it was the best or worst 12 minutes, I'm just going to grade what the final edit was, you know, the director's cut, so to speak, and not what was left on the cutting room floor. But that can factor in. Obviously, a match that goes 8 minutes and there's a 3.5 commercial break in the middle, it's ridiculous to star rate it. I mean, almost half the match wasn't even there. So, that's the thing. You don't hear me talking a lot about star ratings on TV shows, because I don't think the point of a match on TV is to have a good match. I think it's a necessary ingredient in the aggregate, but it's not what a match should be judged on a TV show.
Yeah, I actually don't really take it seriously unless it's the like the G1 or the Best of Super Junior, which is a tournament, and it's mainly to compare what everybody else in the same, you know,
yeah,
doing the same thing, you know, Because, you know, like when it's even like what you mentioned on the pay-per-view, it's just more of an entertainment value in terms of like how much did I entertain the story. And on the New Japan Pride podcast, I mentioned a lot that, you know, sometimes it's the build to the story that or the storyline they're telling in the ring and not necessarily the, you know, the action necessarily that you know, adds to it. You know, it's the whole
yeah.
shebang, you know?
Yeah. I'd love to talk more about this, but we got a broadening hat beyond.
One last question. This was just weird. Have they been always putting Trent's name with a question mark? Because when they had the title, you know, previewing his match with Penta, they had Trent with a question mark. Is that new, or was that a mistake, or have I just not been
it
before?
They've been doing it for forever. Yeah, it's some inside joke that I don't quite fully grasp. Like, wasn't his name in New Japan Trent Beretta, and now he's just Trent question mark? It's some cutesy poo thing.
Yeah, cutesy poo. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's get rid of the cutesy poo stuff.
Yeah, because that was I always found that weird that Beretta's a much cooler name than Trent. So I guess that might be it. You know, Trent, really? You want to go with that? I guess that must be it. But yeah, okay. So that's pretty much all I had. So.
Cool. Thanks, Javier. Always great hearing from you.
All right. Have a good night.
Yep. Take care. Eric, do you want to wrap up because I know it's getting late for you, or do you want to take some emails? We've gone so long.
I'm open for another 15 minutes if you want to. I'm also willing to tap out if you want to tap out.
No, I'm good doing emails. I feel bad if we don't. So let's do that. All right. And the subject lines indicate some good variety of topics here. So Joe from New York, tonight was the first night AEW was by themselves, and I think they did way too much wrestling. Tonight they probably had some NXT viewers, and tonight was a night to go heavy on promos. Let the people get to know who some of the wrestlers are and give the wrestlers a chance to talk. Ratings have gone down a lot over the last month, and I think a lot of that is because of too many 15-minute wrestling matches for guys who have not won the fans over yet. AEW needs more promos. It's missing in their product, and promos are what make people connect with the wrestler. I think there's been episodes like that, Eric. I don't think this was that episode. Like, I think this had a pretty good balance. And when the wrestling is heavy because you do a 23-minute, 4-star, give or take, tag team match to open, that really, you know, just puts out there, this is who we are, this is what our brand is about, or a big part of our brand for those of you who have been watching NXT. And then you have the Bucks open the show with a promo, and you have Kenny and Don and the Bucks do a promo, and you have multiple pre-taped short video packages where wrestlers are presenting their characters, and you have MJF and Mike Tyson talk, and you have Chris Jericho talk, and I know I'm missing some. I mean, Christian Cage, you know, and Taz. I mean, wasn't a long Christian promo before he got interrupted, and it was a setup for an angle, but it was still a promo. I think this actually was a pretty good balance. I think this, you know, you can say, oh, maybe the Darby Matt match should have been a couple minutes shorter. It got a little ridiculous. But other than that, I mean, you and I talked last time you're on the show about squash matches. I do not think a show slows down when you have two matches that go a minute to help establish a new wrestler and their finishing holds and their personality, as opposed to, you know, 50-50 booking, we've got to go 8 to 11 minutes all the time, or it's people will be mad because it's a squash. I thought that the cadence of everything was just of a real good variety. Video packages, promos, wrestling, long matches, short matches, medium.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the sheer number of matches, they only had 6 tonight. I think they normally might have 7 or 8, and 2 of those were squashes. So,
yeah.
I mean, they really only had 4, you know, one with the opening match and the closing match were long matches. I think if you were – I don't think it's a good idea for AEW to veer in the other direction where they used to not have enough promos for fear of people turning the channel. You know, you don't want to be NWA Power, right? I mean, have Nick Aldis come out 3 times in an hour and give varying degrees of the same promo. But, you know, I think if they wanted to move toward a mix, tonight was a good first step in striking a balance that way.
Yeah. Yep. All right. In a larger sense, setting aside Joe's specifics that he liked or didn't like, was this a good introductory show for people who haven't been watching
And did it feel like it had its eye on the idea that we might have 200,000-300,000 people watching us who normally don't? Or at least a good chunk of them don't watch us live, and we want to get them in the habit of watching us live.
Yeah, I mean, I think I said before they had two recognizable names. You know, they had Matt Hardy and they had Jericho. So if you didn't know that much about wrestling, you knew these two guys were on the show. So that could be
and Christian.
Yeah, Christian. So that could be drawing points for you. And then
Rusev was another promo on the list of promos. If we're going to add to our case, there was a lot of promos on this one.
I forgot about that one. He sort of buried Kip Sabian in his promo.
Yeah, that's weird.
I don't think that's the bigger loss there is Penelope Ford disappearing from television, not Kip Sabian, who's always just kind of been meh. I think yes, it was a good introductory show because they did more video packages. So if you missed last week's show, and a lot of people did, as it turns out, at least on the same night. What did you say? 688,000.
Yeah.
You got a little bit of understanding before each match what set up the match, what the match was about, right? So you weren't going in cold.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just the number of viewers from January 6th through Feb 24, before the Shaq appearance, the average number was 771. They were down, you know, 80-some thousand last week from what the average was before the Shaq match. And it's not devastating, but that's more than 10%. You know, I mean, it's something. So having a show that welcomes them back instead of making them feel lost is a positive, is a point I'm making. All right, so let's go to JV from Detroit. I think it's say the Bucks have finally settled on a heel role. That being said, the unmasking spot with Rey Fénix needed to be explained a little bit better tonight, in my opinion. Is Fénix completely incapable of wrestling without his mask? Is it like Samson losing his hair? I get that in Lucha Libre wrestling, the mask is sacred, but I think they need to do a better job explaining that on Dynamite if they're going to use a spot like that. As always, love the show and go VIP. Yeah, that felt like we want to protect Fénix, so we're going to have him cover his face, because covering his face is more important than protecting himself from being blindsided by a super kick and losing a match. If that's your finish, you better make sure people understand why he's so – that he'd be willing to be kicked in the face or kicked in the hands covering his face and lose a match. He just spent 20-some minutes trying to win because he's so scared to do what everyone except Excalibur does.
I'm like, I know the finish of this is – Pac doesn't job and Fénix does job, and how are they going to do it? And they went to the sort of cheapest way possible to protect him. I think this is the second time they've done this finish now. I can't remember if it was Fénix or Penta who had their mask yanked off and it caused them to lose a key match, probably sometime in the last 6 months of 2020. So that's a, well, you don't want to go to too often. It doesn't bother me as much because I understand why, but I could see if you were a new viewer, you'd want more of an explanation on that.
And even if you know why, it doesn't mean you're not allowed to say, boy, that's really dumb. I invested in a match, rooted for one team to beat another team, and the guy was so willing to hide that he cared. So I cared about him winning the match more than he did because he was willing to get kicked in the face and lose to protect his face being shown. I mean, you really culturally need to make that matter without insulting the viewers who were rooting for this guy. I mean, if I'm rooting for my hockey team to win and it's overtime and a guy drops his glove and now all of a sudden he just stops playing because he has to go grab his glove and the other team scores in overtime to win, culturally that better make sense to me or I'm going to be pissed off that I invested in that game.
I mean, so Excalibur spends longer than 5 seconds explaining it and Jim Ross cuts him off and does some cranky old man thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the question is that part of the wrestling culture? Is that part of the wrestling culture from another country that you want to bring into the AEW universe? And if you do, then if you're going to bring that in, it doesn't make sense on the face of it. So you really, no pun intended, so you really need to then invest in explaining it. And that's sort of the criticism, I think, of AEW sometimes is they cater to people who have a doctorate in international wrestling. And, oh, it's a trios match, not a six-man match. Aren't we special? Like, just create your own world and make sure that if you, whatever your structure is and whatever the rules that guide wrestlers is, you've got to introduce that to the people on TNT who haven't been studying international wrestling culture. And you can argue they've done enough by having Excalibur say it and Jim Ross cut him off. But, and maybe it's just the necessary evil in some cases that you can't catch people up on a century of of history on everything, but then do a straight finish. You know, instead of making Rey Fénix look bad for not caring enough about a match to win it because he's worried about his face and not having explained it to the audience, just have him lose.
Yeah, I mean, they need, you know, unlike WWE, AEW has, if not all clean finishes, they have every match has a finish, right? Somebody's eating a pin or submitting at the end of it for the most part. I mean, 99% of the matches probably so far. And you want to protect people still, and you want to get a little creative, and, you know, they've done it twice now, so how about a moratorium on ripping off the mask for the rest of the year at least?
Yeah, and I my issue is just how many people watching go, I invested in Ray and Pac winning, and they didn't care about winning more than he cared about protecting his face, and I don't get why. Like, I just think they need to understand there's a lot of people watching who think that.
That's a fair point.
Yeah. All right, up next, James in Clemson says, I think I figured out what to do with Jade Cargill. Eric, what would you do with Jade Cargill before I read his idea?
I'd send her back to the training center and give her 6 to 9 more months of seasoning under the tutelage of Dustin Rhodes before I gave her the big push on TV.
Yeah. So he says, what's her biggest problem? She showboats too much. What if Jade was pushed in a more Goldberg manner with less showboating and more just ass kicking and short time frames? What do you guys think? P.S., sorry about this, Wade, but I'd like to nominate Todd Martin to be the other voice in the booking room. The guy is money.
No, that's there.
Yeah. So what with Jade, I mean, the praise that she's received for some of the stuff that she's done, I think is deserved. And I think it comes with the qualification of she better keep learning. You know, like, I don't want this to be, oh, I've made it. Look at me. I stand out when I walk around the locker room. I'm clearly, you know, have it go to her head and like have the TB hype go to her head in the sense that you've still got to earn it. I mean, Bianca Belair is facing that. You know, she's a star and she's been great. But, you know, there's a whole locker room full of women who are like, all right, but you got to keep getting better because they really have paved the way for her. So, you know, on a meta level, Jade, and a storyline level, you know, Jade's got to continue to show improvement or the fans will turn on her because they're going to be looking at her with suspicion that she's getting a push because of the physical appearance. And AEW fans especially want more than that.
Yeah, I mean, they have tried to – they gave her some pre-taped promo time, which, given her level of experience, is the way to go. What was her catchphrase? I'm that bitch, I think. And, you know, I mean, I think that works for her and her persona, and culturally it works for her. Bill Goldberg, it's not like he started out as Bill Goldberg all caps. He had to find, you know, they had to figure out what works, and then they remembered, oh, my God, hey, you know, somebody noticed, maybe it was Mike Tenay, hey, you know, he's got a winning streak going here. Why don't we make that a part of his thing and just have him squash everybody and keep it going? And it worked. It got over huge, right? He can still make appearances today.
But it would have been good if along the way he was secretly becoming a good wrestler and a good promo.
Yeah, I mean, I think WCW in the late 90s was not exactly the most conducive workplace. You weren't really being incentivized to become a five-star Goldberg there, right?
No,
you were just
no.
trying to keep your spot so that Kevin Nash, Scott Hall doesn't end up tasering you and Kevin Nash wins the title from you, ending your streak. Oh, wait, that actually happened, yeah.
Yes, yeah. All right, there's a rabbit hole we can go down. Zach in Texas is up next. This was a really good episode of Dynamite, bookended by absolute bangers. The Bucks then... he has to do this, doesn't he? Triangula de la Muerte tried to murder each other in the ring, and then Darby and Matt Hardy tried to kill each other everywhere else. Lord, that coffin drop was insane. Darby is a madman, and I love him for it. I also love the debut of Anthony Ogogo. The one hitter quitter liver punch was a unique finish, and the ref stoppage was a nice touch. No, it wasn't. Speaking of good punches, Mike Tyson's hands are still frighteningly fast. Cash never saw that coming. Not to leave the women out, Jade Cargill is way better than she has any business being 4 matches into her career. There might be truth to that, by the way. But it is still 4 matches, and you have to get much, much better before usually you get TV time. Chris Statlander didn't look like she missed a beat in her return, other than the last 2 moves. And, I'm sorry, Zach. I'm totally, totally can't help myself here. But most importantly, though, it looks like we're finally working toward a Britt Baker title match, and that's a good thing. I agree. It's time to put the strap on her. It's amazing how much the AEW women's division has turned around in the last 3 or 4 months.
I mean, going from abysmal to maybe semi-passable, that is progress. It's all how your matter of perspective. Do you know who would not have struggled to pronounce the Death Triangle name?
Todd Martin.
He would have nailed that.
Because he had a mean Spanish teacher, and I didn't take Spanish ever. And that Spanish teacher taught him how to speak Spanish, and he's very good at it.
Yeah, I took French for 4 years, which was one of the dumber decisions I've ever made.
I bet it helped your brain, though.
Sure.
I mean, you can learn math and never apply that math, but it's like, you know, lifting weights. You're never going to actually do that movement in real life, but it makes your muscles stronger.
Yeah, but if I didn't...
I think you're smart because you took French. I think one of you.
Thank you. I assume you took French, too, then?
No, I did. I took no foreign languages, and I think I would have benefited.
Wow, you would think McAllister would have made you take some foreign language just, you know, as a matter of course or high school. I don't know.
No, you would think so. Somehow, I know I took computer programming at a time when that was the option or foreign language.
Okay. If I learned Spanish, I'd be able to converse with more people in my everyday life than I presently am able to. So anyway.
All right, let's go. Where were we? Yep. John in Tennessee. Overall, I enjoyed this episode of Dynamite, but the main event was a mess. First off, Matt Hardy shouldn't be challenging for titles or working one-on-one matches anymore. His best days are past him, and having a main event on a show makes AEW look like an off-brand version of WWE. Secondly, I'm all for using a big roster, but these lower card faction brawls each week must stop. Finally, is there any word on the second AEW show? They could really use one soon, as a lot of the wrestlers are getting lost in the shuffle. They could really use one, as a lot of the talent are getting lost in the shuffle while WWE mid-carders like Hardy, Miro, and Christian are taking up TV time. Whoa, those are shots fired. Miro and Christian are mid-carders. Thanks for all the great content. Everyone go VIP. I do not think Miro and Christian are perceived as mid-carders. I mean, Christian is, you know, top of the second tier. That's not mid-card. And Miro is a guy with a lot under-push that people perceive deserved better than he got. I wouldn't say they're defined as mid-carders. I think Dolph Ziggler is probably like the standard for like, you know, the border of being mid-card or not.
Just about everybody in WWE isn't defined as a mid-carder by the 50-50 booking. AEW doesn't tend to do that. I think Matt Hardy's shelf life is a lot shorter than I thought it would be. In AEW. I mean, he was introduced.
He's had a long career, yeah.
Yeah, but just in AEW, like, I don't want to say he's sort of used up at this point, 13 months into his tenure, but, man, he's had lots of resets and gimmick changes and he is tonight like his last high big, you know, TV main event to see, barring some another change in character, when you lose the TV title, the secondary belt match, and I don't think he's ever gotten the world title match, he just seems like he hit his ceiling and is maybe destined to play out the string a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine for him having a hardcore match every now and then, and I think that's probably the main area he can contribute in ring. I think having him talk and keep a gimmick for a year and a half, like, let's just stick with this. I think he's smarmy, and I think he plays the role well of the agent advisor who's trying to take advantage of younger wrestlers and, you know, can help them, but at the same time is acting like it's more altruistic than it is. I think there's something in that. I don't have a problem with Matt's current character, and I don't have a problem with him headlining a TNT title match. It's a secondary title, and Darby won. And I think Darby should defend the title enough that Matt Hardy, by necessity, needs to be in the mix because there's only so many people you can main event a TV show with in a TNT title match on that roster who can lose clean to Darby. So I'm fine with it. I mean, it'd be, you know, I mean, I don't blame anyone for, you know, being over Matt Hardy and being ready to move on, but I don't think he's in any way like, I don't think anyone would watch AEW and go, well, this guy must have booking power because he's over pushing himself. I just think you could say that about a lot of talent that maybe you push other people instead, but it's not like he's a dominant figure on the show.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I figured he'd be more I thought he'd be more of a top tier guy given how he came in. And he, you know, I guess you could make the argument that he's being used perfectly now because he's putting over Hangman Page and Darby Allin in his last two high profile matches, which is exactly what you want him to be doing at this point in his career.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, I think this is a good use of him. All right, Kevin in North Carolina. Got to have dangly bits to be part of the Elite? Gallows and Anderson seem to be lacking then. Just awful. Kenny is much funnier in his own mind than he actually is. What a goofball group. I miss Jon Moxley as a champ. At least he took it seriously. I do agree with the statement, Kenny is much funnier in his own mind than he actually is. Now, humor is in the eye of the beholder. It's subjective. Eric, Kenny is not a top-tier money-drawing heel world champion act. There are slices in there that if they were expanded and others were reduced, we're in business, but that discipline and self-awareness is not there.
Yeah. Kenny Omega, I don't want to say he has a lifetime pass with me because of the third Omega Okada match that is my favorite wrestling match of all time. I just love it and was edge of my seat for the full 70 minutes during it. And it's one of the things that sort of cemented my desire to, like, you know, watch pro wrestling on a regular basis again. But yeah, I mean, he's been disappointing and frustrating in AEW, and he's very thin-skinned about the criticism, right? Every time he needs to get over and explain why something was done, he goes to his kind of house organ at Sports Illustrated and gets that guy to write a glowing, long profile of him and where he's at and his artistry. You could still salvage Kenny Omega. The Good Brothers, there may not be an act in wrestling I hate more than the Good Brothers at this point in time. Like, I'd rather watch a Yano Colt Cabana match than hear the Good Brothers do their stupid dick jokes every week. And if you watch BTE like I do while you're having lunch every Monday, it's about 50 times worse on there because they just run amok with the dick jokes, and it's obnoxious, it's juvenile, it's not funny. I don't like it.
Yeah. All right, Shay from New York City. Jade and Red Velvet was everything I was hoping it would be. I've enjoyed this feud straight through. I felt like they both had good promos leading up to this match, and tonight they delivered a match with intensity, which fit the build. I fear for whatever followed that Bucks opener, but they held their own. Both came out looking great. Jade will probably get more praise, but both will be big players in the future of the division. With Statlander's return and Ty Conti's rise and Britt continuing to be awesome, I can honestly say I enjoy the women's division now. Sheeta, Riho, Nyla Rose are also nice talents. Have you guys enjoyed the women's division more lately? We covered that quite a bit, Eric, but have you enjoyed it more lately than the low bar set by the first year of the company?
I mean, sure. But that's, again, damning with faint praise. I guess I probably liked Cargill and Red Velvet more than most people tonight. I've seen nothing but positive praise for it, and I just thought – I felt it was slow-paced and there's not a lot of flow, but I will acknowledge they did get about the best match out of each other, given their relative level of experience, that they could tonight.
Yeah, yeah. And it was 7 minutes with a commercial break in the middle with some action at ringside. I mean, it wasn't – you know, they're swinging each other into barricades. And I mean, there's, you know, some people have that level of variety in the ring and out of the ring and some big moves, and it's going to pass a bar. And I'd rather they do that than go 12 minutes if they can't go 12 minutes yet, you know? So in that sense, I think that was smart. Kenny Bucks, Good Brothers and Don are the best group of scumbags from the way they dress, speak, and now wrestle. I love it. That opening match was incredible, and the Young Bucks were far more interesting in that match than I've ever seen them. I agree. The Bucks had to pick a lane. I feel like I'm a viewer that just sits back and enjoys the ride most weeks. However, even I was losing my patience with the Bucks characters. I'm glad they finally have picked a lane. Week one is a big success, in my opinion. So all's well that ends well here.
Was that you, or was that the email?
I said all's well that
okay.
Well.
My little transition to you.
I know I should have.
Your flourish. I got it. Yeah. At this point, you know, I'm. I think we're both woozy, but. I think the Young Bucks were good tonight, and hopefully it will be things to come. I wonder if you would tell the story from the Young Bucks perspective, if they think they've spun a masterpiece since.
Oh, I know. I wonder that too.
Like, was it early December, December 2nd show when Kenny Omega won the title and left, and then Kenny's going to his, maybe it was even before this, Kenny walked out on somebody and the Bucks were chasing him out, and Kenny got in a limo and said, "You're either in, you're out." They didn't get in the car.
Yeah.
Was that maybe at the September pay-per-view? Whatever it was, you know, had they thought in their minds, they've been spinning this well-honed Hamlet routine of should we join Kenny or not ever since then, and we've just missed out on their brilliance. I wonder if that's how they view it.
I think there is an attitude prevalent within AEW and people who fawn over their booking that think you're just not getting it, you're not that bright, you're biased, you're not paying attention if you don't see the beautifully woven story that, you know, to me, that if nobody buys your album, it's not, you know, it's not a commercial success. And you can say artistically it went new places, but in this case, string it all together and put it on YouTube, like just official video. Here is the entire storyline, no edits, a complete, put the date and everything the Bucks have done that is related to this story, and string it together with dates on the bottom of each and let people decide for themselves.
Is this is the guy who does that stuff, the great videos that they do in the run up to a pay-per-view, is his name Kevin Sullivan?
Yeah.
Not crazy demonic heel from WCW in Florida, but yeah, I mean, that guy does great work. If he could probably salvage this thing if they gave him enough time and runway.
And I'd like to see them do it. I'd love to have the Bucks sit down with Don and Kenny and even if it's a pure YouTube video type thing. They certainly have enough content up there, but maybe have something that helps the main product a little more. Just sit down and do a segment where they go over every twist and turn and show it. You know, they go, "Well, it was on TV already. We don't need to show you." Well, you know, there's a lot of television. Just go and show us everything and tell us what your mindset was and walk through it. Kind of the actors talking over, you know, in a director's cut DVD extra. Tell us where their mind was. And even if it's retroactively making it up and BSing as you go, it'd be kind of fun to do something like that. And you know, shut up the critics by proving it was a master plan.
This is a complete tangent, but could you imagine if Kenny Omega had actually signed with WWE and did his sort of flaky Kenny routine, his dances to the beat of his own drummer routine, how that would have gone over with Vince McMahon? Could you imagine? He'd be on he'd either be like Aleister Black and just buried and forgotten, or he'd be riding a scooter around.
Yeah,
like
no,
Matt Riddle.
Vince is going to see something and go, "I don't like it. Never do that again. I don't like that. That doesn't make sense to me. Nope." And that's it. Then the whole machinery doesn't allow that to happen. And there'll be producers going, "But Kenny, you can't do that. Here's what we want you to do." And Kenny's like, "I don't want to do that." And they go, "Well, John Moxley didn't either, but he made the best of it. Until your contract's up, make the best of it." And then he has a choice. He can make the best of it or not. But there's no way Kenny is doing what he's doing now in WWE.
No, but it would have been hilarious to see him try and then get cut off at the knees. It just would have been, he'd have been miserable. So he obviously made the right decision for his career, but alternate universe.
Yeah. Back to Shay. He goes, "My first impression of Anthony Ogogo is he's going to be a star. I have to see more in ring. I would hope so. But last week's promo and his presence tonight was really good." Any thoughts on him? Yeah, Eric, it's super early, but I mean, he's got a presence.
Yeah. The one punch thing did not come out of nowhere when they did the big QT Marshall versus Cody exhibition where they were ripping off Zbyszko Bruno, paying homage to it. Two or three weeks ago, whatever it was, you know, Ogogo did lay somebody out. It might have even been Cody, who the next week in his promo came out and said, "That was the hardest I've ever been hit." I mean, it's not like they didn't set it up, but
I'm fine with a punch knockout. I just don't like the referee stopping the match the way he did. I'm fine with people winning with one punch. I mean, that's a fine gimmick. That's a change of pace. And I mean, I don't love it, but I mean, if you have something in mind for it, my just issue is just the referee should be consistent.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a hard gimmick to sell. a punch, right? Like when Goldberg just squashed everybody in a minute or less, he just had his limited moveset, and that's why he was booked the way he was booked, and it got over. I mean, with this guy, I guess raising somebody up for a jackhammer and spearing them looks pretty badass, right? Did back then, still does today. I mean, Roman Reigns and Edge, you know, they use the spear, but wrestlers get punched and slapped 50 times in a match, right? It's the basic move. And so one guy's punch is so great that it ends the match. It just, that seems like a tough sell and makes other guys on the roster in every promotion in the world look weak, right? Because they, you know, how is it that this guy can end a match with a punch, but nobody else can? I don't know. It just seems weird. It's different. I'll need to live with it a little more, I think.
Yeah. Shay says, ratings may be hurt by the challenge season finale tonight, but I hope a good number of people tuned in. For many, this may have been their first time watching AEW in a while. Overall, a really fun show. I needed this since I regretfully gave Raw a chance after a nice Mania weekend, and I learned my lesson there. And then finally, Javier just added this, so I'll just, 'cause we talked about it earlier. I looked up why Thunder Rosa wasn't on AEW after the Lights Out match. The best I can figure is NWA Power taped March 21st through the 24th. It overlapped on AEW show on the 24th. So sometimes logistics get in the way, and they just got to accept the criticism that comes along from using someone who has other commitments.
Yeah, I mean, you know, especially during the pandemic, there were guys last year who just disappeared off TV in both promotions, and they really weren't telling you why, but you had a pretty good idea of why.
Yes, yes. Well, we'll wrap up there, Eric. Long show. I hope everybody enjoyed it. I appreciate the caller and email contributions, and always fun talking with you about AEW, Eric. And if people want to read more of your work, they can become a VIP member and go into the back issues and read some of your columns.
Well, I'm sure they were awful. I was like 18 or 19 or whatever. Yeah, I didn't know what I was doing. but thank you. Yes, go VIP just because you have access to so many articles and podcasts. It's totally worth it.
Thank you. Anything else you want to plug or say, Eric, before we sign off?
No, but subscribe to your local newspaper.
Yes, that counts as, that's a yes. You don't get to say no and then say something.
No. Yeah, no.
That's an ongoing thing with callers. I'm like, do you have anything else you want to add? No, but, and then they ask another question or make it.
You know, it's the old, yeah, no.
totally.
Midwestern thing, yeah.
Absolutely. I have nothing else to say except follow me on Twitter, @TheWadeKeller. Follow our brand, @PWTorch. Visit PWTorch.com. And if you're jonesing for some NXT talk, check out the NXT Talks PWT or PWT Talks NXT show. Although I would listen to an NXT Talks PWT show with Kelly and Tom and Nate over on the PW Torch Daily Cast. Just search PW Torch on your podcast app and subscribe. It's free. Thanks again, Eric. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Wade.